Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Public Utilities Commission meeting. It is June 23rd, 2009, at approximately 9:30 in the morning. We're here in the state capitol. This is the time and place noticed for this Public Utilities Commission meeting. I'm Dusty Johnson. Joining me this morning are my colleagues Steve Kolbeck and Gary Hansen. I think we'll mix up the agenda a little bit this morning, if that's acceptable, my colleagues. We'll go ahead and proceed through administration concern reports and consumer complaints, but then we'll move the telecommunications item up ahead of electric and grain, and then that which will allow grain to be last, which we like because that may take a little more time, as well as moving the telecom up to accommodate some folks. So does anybody have any concerns with that? Hearing none, we'll proceed. The first item is the approval of the minutes of the commission meeting held on April 7th. Those minutes have been circulated and reviewed. Are there any corrections or amendments? Hearing none, is there a motion?
I move to approve the minutes.
Motion has been made. No second is required, so we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Next is a status report from Ms. Gregg on our Consumer Affairs Division.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson. The Commission has received a total of 108 contacts since the last report was prepared for the June 10th, 2009 Commission meeting. 20 of the contacts involved telecommunication service, 28 of the contacts involved electric service, 8 contacts involved natural gas service, 14 contacts involved cell phone service, 19 contacts related to the Do Not Call Registry, 1 contact related to the Keystone Pipeline, 1 contact involved wind energy, 1 contact involved the Grain Warehouse Division, and 16 contacts related to issues not regulated by the PUC. 1,308 of the 1,357 complaints received in 2009 have been resolved, and 2,512 of the 2,513 complaints received in 2008 have been resolved.
Thank you, Ms. Gregg. Any questions? All right, hearing none, we'll proceed to consumer complaints. Item number one, that's CT09-001. This deals with a complaint made, filed by Brian Henkel, which dealt with unauthorized switching of services. Recently, Sprint filed a motion to dismiss the complaint. This time, we'll look to Mr. Wazorek for comments for his client.
Thank you, Commissioner. The motion is fairly straightforward. It sets forth and explains how, under the law, Sprint is not an initiating carrier and cannot be considered for the purposes of a slamming complaint. If one actually looks at the complaint as filed, the complaint on its face admits that Sprint did not make the request to transfer. It specifically says that a mistake was made by Express Communications, and Express Communications sent its instructions to Zone Telecom, who then asked Sprint to execute the change. Based on that, both under state law and federal law, Sprint cannot be liable for the complaint for a slamming charge.
Thanks very much, Mr. Zorek. I don't think Mr. Henkel's on the phone or in person, but we'll double check that. And then we'll look to staff for their comments.
Thank you. This is Kara Semler for staff. We support Sprint's statements. We agree, based on all the information that we looked at and we studied, that it did not initiate a change. It is not at fault. It was simply following directions, and we recommend that it be dismissed from this docket.
Thanks very much, Ms. Semler. I should also at this time see if either Zone or Express has any comments. Okay. Hearing none, Ms. Simler, do you have any idea from the complainant how he views this motion?
I did. I spoke with him this morning, and he does support it. And, in fact, it sounds like they're working on a resolution with the other two companies. So I think you'll be seeing that filing shortly.
Thanks. Other questions? Hearing no questions, are there any comments or action?
I'll motion to let the commission dismiss Sprint and the complaint.
Okay. Motion has been made. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, at this time, we'll proceed to our telecommunications portion of our docket. Item number one deals with petitions for arbitration, dealing with dockets TC07-112 through 116. Question for the commission today is, shall the commission approve the stipulation for the amended scheduling order? Who would like to address this first? Ms. Moore, good morning.
Good morning, Commissioners.
Meredith Moore appearing on behalf of the petitioners in this matter. We previously agreed to a stipulation for scheduling order with Altel in this matter for the continuation of some discovery, other testimony filings to support the revised FLEX study that the commission ordered we produce in this particular matter, and the dates have been agreed upon. Those have been submitted to staff as well and have been approved, and so we would simply ask that the commission approve the stipulation this morning. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Moore. Altel, have any comments?
I don't have any.
Okay, Altel has no comments. Staff?
Staff, this is Karen Kramer of staff, and staff would recommend approving the amended scheduling order.
Thanks very much. Questions? Hearing none, any comments or action?
Mr. Chairman, I move to that the commission approve the stipulation for amending the scheduling order.
Motion has been made. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks.
Thank you.
Item number two is TC08-031. This deals with a complaint filed by Kennebec Telephone Company against Altel regarding non-payment of transiting charges. And the question before the commission this morning is how shall it proceed regarding the motion for summary judgment that was made by Kennebec. This time we'll turn toward Kennebec.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Meredith Moore appearing on behalf of Kennebec Telephone Company this morning. In this particular matter, Kennebec Telephone filed a complaint originally against Altel for non-payment of transiting charges associated with approximately 17.5 miles of the Kennebec Telephone network from its Presho office to the Golden West Vivian exchange. This is a matter that has its origins dating back to the late 90s, at which time there was actually a written agreement in place between Kennebec Telephone and Altel's predecessor, which I believe was then WWC License or Western Wireless at that particular time. That agreement was in place from 1999 to 2002, and it was actually the reciprocal compensation agreement between the two companies as well, which happened to contain a specific provision relating to transiting traffic and the compensation of that transiting traffic. The rate in that particular agreement was 0.0005. When the reciprocal compensation agreement was terminated in late 2002, the parties decided, and specifically Kennebec Telephone and its consultants decided, that it would be best to have a separate agreement for dealing with transit traffic as opposed to simply having a provision within a continuing reciprocal transport and termination agreement. So therefore, what happened was Kennebec retained the services of Consortia Consulting and asked that they contact Altel, and then it would have been Western Wireless again, I believe, and enter into negotiations for a specific transiting agreement. That contact was made, and in fact, a proposed agreement was sent to Altel in care of Mr. Ron Williams at the time, and that particular agreement set out the terms for the transiting, the territory that would be covered, as well as the rate, which was, again, the 0.0005 rate. Essentially, what happened after that, it's my understanding there were some telephonic discussions and perhaps some other discussions in person, but unfortunately, that agreement that was proposed in May of 2004 to Altel by Kennebec was never signed. However, there was never any rejection correspondence received from Altel, at least from what we can find in our own files. And Kennebec continued to provide the transiting service related to these 17.5 miles and also continued to bill at the 0.0005 rate. In looking through the history of Kennebec's cab statements and receipts for payment from Altel for the same, there is no dispute notice given with regard to the fact that there wasn't an agreement to cover transiting traffic for this particular service that was provided. So therefore, the arrangement essentially continued without a formal contract in place to govern. However, the invoices were sent and they were paid. In April of 2007, what would have been without explanation to my client, Altel ceased paying the transiting invoices in this particular matter. Some discussions were initiated without resolution, and ultimately the complaint that's currently before this commission was filed in that matter. Shortly after that complaint was filed, I, on behalf of Kennebec, was contacted by then-counsel for Alltel, Mr. Sean Simpson, who's no longer with Alltel. We engaged in some informal discovery. I know initially some pleadings were put before this commission indicating that Kennebec had not responded to the informal questions. However, unfortunately, Mr. Simpson had simply not forwarded on to Mr. Wazorek, and I believe also to some other individuals within Alltel, that we had, in fact, had conference calls and had emails and actually did answer the questions that Mr. Simpson had proposed regarding the history of the transiting arrangement, as well as the other carriers involved, the other carriers who transited traffic as well on this particular route. And after that particular conversation, it appeared to counsel for both parties, then counsel Mr. Simpson, who obviously can't be here today, wouldn't be here today, and isn't with Alltel anymore, so his statements would no longer be binding at this stage, but at that point in time he represented, it appeared to be a straightforward matter for resolution by the commission. We then proceeded to make this motion for summary judgment, viewing this matter as simply a legal matter, which is whether there is, in fact, a valid contract between Kennebec and Alltel in this matter for the transiting service and therefore the corresponding payment at the 0005 rate. And I would submit to you that under South Dakota law, there can be either expressed or implied contracts. Well, we don't have the specific written agreement in this particular case and certainly wish that we did. That does not in any way prevent you from finding that there is, in fact, an implied contract between the parties based upon the invoices submitted to Alltel by Kennebec Telephone Company and also based upon the conduct of the parties by Kennebec, of course, providing the service at issue, as well as Alltel rendering payment for the service at issue for a very significant period of time after that original written contract was proposed to Alltel in May of 2004. It's been suggested in Alltel's responsive pleadings that ultimately Quest may bear some responsibility for payment. However, I think that's a red herring. And I don't know how Quest could be involved because, of course, this is Kennebec's network, and Kennebec controls the 17.5 miles that are at issue in this particular matter. Kennebec has never been contacted by Quest, and, in fact, Kennebec has attested that they have never been contacted by Alltel to indicate that there is any sort of agreement between Quest and Alltel. Even if there is an agreement between Alltel and Quest, if that's the case, then that's a side issue between Alltel and Quest, because Alltel and Quest can't contract somehow to involve the 17.5 miles of the Kennebec network for purposes of transiting, because Kennebec has continued to provide the transiting service to Alltel, has continued to submit those invoices. So no one is receiving double payment here by any stretch of the imagination, and if there is some sort of agreement between Alltel and Quest, that's something that those two parties need to resolve on their own, and that's not something that should stand in the way of this commission being able to look at this matter, look at it as a question of law, ultimately, as to whether there is, in fact, a contract between these two parties. And we would submit to you that there is a contract based upon the conduct of the parties, that a benefit has been conferred upon Alltel here through the merits of the transiting service provided, and that Kennebec is therefore entitled to a judgment. Mr. Bauer, the general manager of Kennebec Telephone Company, has supplied two affidavits in this particular matter attesting to the amount of the transiting traffic the amount of the invoices owed, which through the end of May would be $255,000 approximately. And so, therefore, we would submit to this commission that no further discovery in this matter is needed. The facts, as they need to be for purposes of establishing the existence of a contract, are clear, as are the amounts that are owed. And to the extent that there's any suggestion that the rate here isn't appropriate, this has been the rate that has been in place since the late 90s in regard to this particular matter. So it's certainly not something that has been altered in any way, shape, or form, and it's certainly something that Alltel has seen before. So therefore, we would respectfully request that the Commission grant summary judgment to Kennebec Telephone on both the existence of the contract as well as the damages that we outlined in Mr. Bauer's affidavit, which was recently submitted. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Moore. We'll hold questions until we hear from other counsel. Mr. Wazorek.
Thank you, Commissioner. I would like to open my comments before I kind of get into the meat of this. First, to apologize to the commission to the fact that I have to file a supplemental affidavit because I wasn't included on some follow-up contact that Sean Simpson had with Ms. Moore. Now, I think there's been an illusion or it's been alluded to that somehow those emails, those follow-up emails, which I don't even believe are in the record, answered all these questions. The supplemental affidavits made clear that, yes, we are incorrect and that there was some follow-up emails, but that we don't believe those questions have been answered by those follow-up emails. And Ms. Moore did also represent she had a conference call with Mr. Simpson. But like I said, those emails and her summary of those calls aren't in the record either. We've looked at them. They've supplied them. The affidavit responds to that and says, look, that doesn't answer those questions, and we think we need to go forward and look at these issues. I'd like to talk a little bit about how we got here, and then I'd like to address Ms. Moore's claim. I mean, Kennebec did file this well over a year ago. This matter has sat last September or August, actually. I think staff counsel contacted the council about moving the matter forward. It was Kennebec that put it off because they had some other things going, and we didn't have an issue with that. And then when staff then does a follow-up in April about, okay, where's this matter at, the response is I get this motion for summary judgment. Motion for summary judgment is a relief where there's not a question of fact. The problem we have here is there's been no discovery to flesh out the facts, so you have affidavits. I think Ms. Moore is fairly loose with her interpretations. It's an interesting aspect that you have an affidavit from Ron Williams saying, look, I was telling these guys I wouldn't agree to this rate when they proposed it. We don't have an affidavit actually from Kennebec's consultant even contesting that. So the facts you're facing right now is in the record, the rate was contested. The fact you have in the record that we're telling them that we thought Quest needed to be involved in this because Ms. Moore says, well, how has Quest become involved in it? Well, we're paying Quest to transit calls to Vivian. Now, the question then becomes, well, is who should be the payer in this situation? If we're already paying Quest, and that's part of our understanding with Quest, to deliver those calls, then shouldn't Kennebec be looking to Quest? And that's an issue that we have raised in this proceeding, and that is raised in the affidavits, and that's an issue still pending. It's by the affidavits. It was raised to Kennebec before in negotiations. It was clearly raised in the response. It creates another question of fact. The thing I find interesting in reviewing the briefs yesterday is Ms. Moore, in her brief, relies significantly on the fact that this commission had a case where it awarded transiting under an implied contract theory of transiting amounts. Now it's the Golden West case, and first of all, that went through trial, and Commissioner Hansen was on the commission during those Golden West cases, and that was one issue of many in those cases, but if I recall correctly, I think we had 7 days of hearings on those cases. And it was post-trial. There are a lot of facts in the record. There's a lot of discussion in the record. The law in this state is, look, if you're going to get an implied contract, the fact whether that exists alone tends to be a material question of fact. So to come at this early and try to put this through, I think, is inappropriate because I think those facts need to be developed. I think the issue has been raised. I think there are questions of facts in the record based on the affidavits. I then, in my brief in response, I point out how, look, this is not the same thing as the Golden West case. As I explained in the Golden West case, those
The arguments were different. The issues were different. It was the Golden West Vivian exchange, whether because of the we had issues whether they were have the same parent umbrella company, whether we should pay Transtein when, or whether that should be considered one network. The commission had in front of it the history of the bills. The commission had in front of it the fact that it wasn't until we were in litigation that Alltel started raising those issues. You have something totally different here where you have records showing where Williams is saying, look, I'm not going to agree to that rate when dealing with their consultant. So the facts are different. The networks are different. The parties are different. And I don't think you can make that. The timing is different. And so I don't think you can make that leap at this point. I think you need to develop the record at a minimum, and I think there are issues here that could very well result in a different decision once it's, the record's properly developed.
Mr. Wisdrock, I'll interrupt quick. We've had a lot of background noise from other folks on the telephone line, so if you could please make sure to mute your phone. Sounds like you're on speakerphone as well. I don't know if that's causing us quite as much trouble as the mute, so thanks.
Mr. Chairman, this is Tom Welk. All of the participants except you seem to be cutting out from time to time regarding their remarks.
That is good to know. We'll try to do some things on our end, Mr. Welk. Thank you. Mr. Wisdrock, go ahead.
Thank you. I think it's
maybe get that mic a little closer just so we can help out, Mr. Wolf. Thanks.
I'll get a tonsillectomy if I get much closer. Regarding Ms. Moore's comment on the rate, it has to be remembered that the rate was not an individual negotiated rate when it was thrown in the 1999 agreement. It was just a rate thrown in when all the RLECs were negotiating jointly with WWC, and it was. So it's not specific to this company. There was no specific determination as to whether this would even be an appropriate rate for this network. Going back to the legal argument, what I find then interesting in Ms. Moore's reply brief to my brief is she doesn't really argue the law. She argues the facts, and that's when somebody's arguing the facts in a motion for summary judgment, it's a pretty clear sign that there's questions of fact. One of the striking things I found about her brief is I spend a good page in my brief on the Vandewall case, how the Supreme Court has said, hey, if you're saying that's not the proper rate, if you're saying somebody else is responsible for it, those raise questions of facts. And she doesn't even address that in her reply. She doesn't cite the case. She doesn't do an analysis. She doesn't distinguish it. And I think it's simply because she knows that based on the factual record that you have right here, she can't overcome that burden. And for those reasons, commissioners, I'd ask that you reject the motion for summary judgment. Okay, it's always kind of hard to argue against motions for summary judgment because you're arguing question of facts and law, and you don't have the history of the hearing. This case is not ripe to be disposed on a summary judgment motion. There are clearly questions of fact. There's clearly information that has to be derived by both parties and set forth before this commission before you take that next step. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Wisdrock. Staff.
Thank you. This is Kara Semler for staff. While I agree with Kennebec that it certainly seems from the behavior of the parties that there was some sort of implied agreement, I also have to agree that there are some facts that we simply don't know. Ms. Moore argued that there is no double payment occurring. However, we just haven't seen any documentation to substantiate or to disprove that. So, with that being said, it seems we should do more discovery and take this to hearing.
Ms. Moore, if you wanted some rebuttal, we'd be happy to give you some time.
Thank you.
is correct in that summary judgment is a matter that does look at the facts, and it certainly looks at the law. However, I would steadfastly disagree with his comment that our reply brief failed to address the law, because the law as it relates to the existence of an implied contract is quite simple, and that is simply whether four elements are met, whether the parties are capable of contracting, in other words, have the capacity to contract. That is, in fact, a question of law. I don't think there's any question but in this particular matter that both Altel and Kennebec and formerly Western Wireless certainly had the capacity to enter into a contract or to enter into such conduct which would evidence the existence of a contract. We then have, of course, the necessity of assent, and in this particular matter, and I would concur with Ms. Semler's comments, that the conduct of the parties in billing for the traffic, providing the service, billing for the traffic, and paying for that would certainly indicate an agreement to have that. Beyond that, of course, we have the question of whether there's a lawful purpose. Well, of course, there is, because there is, in fact, a particular service being provided, which is one that is, of course, contemplated by the telecommunications industry. And what Mr. Wazorek has essentially indicated is that we need significantly more discovery and that it's hard for me to argue my case because I know that there are facts that are still at issue. That's simply not the case. And conversely, what I would say to Altel is that Altel has the burden here. Well, we have the burden of proof, of course. Altel has the burden of diligently meeting Kennebec as far as the facts that it has asserted. And Altel has not put anything in the record as far as evidence of disputing the rate beyond Mr. Williams' affidavit. There are no emails for that. Disputes of these particular bills, there's absolutely nothing along those lines. It's hard to prove a negative. And to a certain extent, that is what Kennebec has been left with here today, is how do we prove the negative of what we're trying to show here, which is, of course, we provided a service, we billed for it, we weren't paid for it. We can't be compensated by anyone else. We didn't submit bills to anyone else. Therefore, we can't establish that we haven't already been paid for anyone else. And with regard to the Quest end of the agreement, the simple fact of the matter is Quest certainly isn't going to transport traffic beyond the end of its network. And the particular section of Kennebec's network that's at issue here starts at the Presho Exchange and goes to Vivian. And so, therefore, there's no way that Quest is going to invade upon that particular territory and provide any service for which it would then be required to compensate Kennebec. That simply doesn't make sense under the facts of this case. There is also authority for this commission. We don't agree that you need to take this particular step at this time, but you can, in effect, take Kennebec's motion for summary judgment and turn it into a motion for partial summary judgment should you believe that that's appropriate. And you can do that by essentially...
Sorry to interrupt, Ms. Moore. Getting a lot of background noise on telephone lines. And if you can do anything on that on your end to minimize that, we'd appreciate it. Go ahead, Ms. Moore.
Thank you. You have the authority to award partial summary judgment on the question of whether there is, in fact, a contract between these two parties. To the extent that there would be any belief that it's necessary to conduct further discovery on the appropriate compensation or the appropriate rate for the service rendered by Kennebec to Altel in this particular case, that can be something that's set aside, subject to further discovery and subject to a potential hearing on the issue. However, I would submit to you that the facts of this case are clear in that the four elements of a contract, and particularly the implied contract in this particular case, have been met, and Kennebec has produced facts which satisfy that, and Altel cannot simply state we disagree with that and ultimately carry its burden of appropriately responding to the summary judgment motion. So therefore, as far as that issue goes, we think at a minimum this commission can answer the question of whether there was in fact an implied contract between these two parties. Altel has taken great lengths to try to differentiate this matter from the Golden West matter, and I think that Mr. Wazorek's comments are well taken and that there certainly was a very involved hearing in that particular process. However, that also related to a reciprocal compensation agreement and some other particular issues under that agreement that took a significant amount of time, including the inter-MTA issue. That was the crux of that particular hearing. And the transiting agreement was, well, certainly significant, not the primary emphasis. And if I recall correctly, in looking through that particular docket, I'm not sure there was a tremendous amount of discovery done on that or even a tremendous inquiry made at the time of the hearing in regard to those particular matters. And I certainly think that the facts before you in regard to the Kennebec matter are, in fact, stronger than what was presented by Golden West at that particular time. And so I certainly think you can look to that for guidance if you want, but moreover, what you can look at is the law in South Dakota as it relates to implied contracts, and I think we've certainly got that here. So I don't believe further discovery is necessary, and if anything, it will only serve to delay this process and effectively muddy the waters on something that could have happened quite some time ago. And again, I will represent to the Commission that in my conversations with Mr. Simpson, he indicated to me that he didn't believe further discovery was necessary. And to that end, Altel has certainly had ample opportunity to ask further questions if it desired to do so, and to date it has not done so, and I don't think that's something that should be held against Kennebec at this point in time. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Moore. Questions by commissioners or advisors? Yes, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Moore, you talk about the four elements of a contract for South Dakota law. Don't contracts of a duration of greater than 1 year need to be in writing?
As it relates to the purchase of real property, yes.
But not
so, well, and as it also relates in this particular matter, what you've also got is you've certainly got an invoice, and an invoice itself constitutes a writing and constitutes a valid contract. So from that matter, if you look at the case law as it relates to the establishment of both express contracts as well as implied contracts through conduct, that does not preclude anyone from finding the existence of a contract under these circumstances where there were, in fact, invoices issued by Kennebec Telephone Company, which I believe were attached to our initial complaint, the CABS billing statements, which were submitted to Altel, as well as payments that would have been received on the same. So that invoice certainly represents a contract. And in many ways, what we would have here would be a number of individual contracts, as well as the overarching principle that the conduct of the parties formed that implied contract and relationship.
Exactly that. It would provide that there are numerous small or short duration contracts, but would it in fact provide, well, I'll let the other counsel argue the other side, but it would seem that if you are going to have a long duration contractual relationship that it would need to be in writing. And I appreciate you articulate your position very well, and I'll listen to what Mr. Wieczorek has to say on the other side of that. Why would you not? I think I know why you would not, and can have my own answers to that, but I'd certainly be interested. Why would you not include Quest in this discussion?
We did not include Quest in this discussion because Kennebec has never been contacted by Quest with regard to the traffic at issue.
But you know the situation here, and you know that Quest will be brought into the discussion, and without them being able to provide answers to us, doesn't that provide a situation where there are actually genuine questions that we need to have answered? And doesn't that preclude us from being able to bench this?
I don't believe it does, Commissioner Hansen. And for the record, the first time that Quest really became a significant issue in this particular matter was after we filed our motion for summary judgment. Prior to that, in my conversations with Mr. Simpson, one of the questions which was posed in an email to me was whether or essentially what was the involvement of Quest in this particular matter. Did we build Quest for transiting traffic? Did we build other carriers for transiting traffic? And Mr. Wieczorek is correct. I don't think the emails are going to answer those questions because Mr. Simpson and I had a conference call to discuss that wherein we specifically went through each of the questions that he asked. And to a certain extent, I'm becoming dangerously close to being a witness in my own matter, so I need to tread lightly here. But at that particular time, we discussed Quest and their involvement in this matter, and essentially that they weren't involved as far as Kennebec goes, and that there were no contacts between Quest to indicate that there was a contract with Altel. At that time, Altel produced no contract between itself and Quest, which would become at issue here. And so, therefore, again, that's why I think it's important that this commission can effectively set aside any of the claims that Altel makes as it relates to Quest, because if there's a contract over there, well, then clearly there may be an issue there that Altel needs to resolve with Quest. But that contract in no way involves Kennebec, and there's never been any evidence produced that we were intended to be a third-party beneficiary or anything along those lines. And the law of contract indicates that they cannot bind Kennebec in any way, shape, or form without making us a party to that contract.
Thank you very much. And, Mr. Chairman, thank you for giving me the leeway. It's rather challenging to ask questions and go through a situation of this nature without asking for specifics and getting into a hearing-type process. Thank you.
Other questions?
I have one for Mr. Resort. Mr. Resort, do you agree that the segment in question is between Pressure and Vivian? Or do you think that it's somewhere else?
No, I think that's, well, I think that's the way we understand that Quest delivers all of its traffic to the Vivian Exchange, or did during this pertinent time period. I can't speak for maybe if there's been changes in the last 6 months. So I don't dispute that that's the way Quest was carrying all of its traffic.
Okay. Well, not necessarily a question, but for Presho, and do you think that Presho's argument is just specifically pertains to that section that is between Presho and Vivian?
That it's my understanding from what we have to date that that is the route they are seeking transiting for.
Okay.
Correct.
That's all. Thanks.
Commissioner Hanson want me to respond to
that? I would love that very much, and I have a follow-up question for you.
Certainly.
On your answer, I guess.
It gets a little hard to respond to a situation that I find myself in, frankly, and that when Ms. Moore makes representations that there's been representations by another counsel that aren't part of the record. And I think the commission, first of all, needs to understand that, you know, if you think you need those kinds of representations to make a decision today, I don't think you can make a decision today because I don't believe they're part of the record, and I don't think you can take representations of counsel of what's gone forward as evidence. As to Ms. Moore correctly answered your question on one-year contracts, generally what the court looks at is when you're getting monthly billings that those aren't necessarily long-term contracts. That's what our courts have done historically. I do take exception to her argument that there's been no objection to these. When part of her it's right on her complaint, we stopped paying in 2007, in April of 2007. And I don't see how one can argue that they've gotten no objection to this payment when Altel contacts says we're not paying anymore because we don't have a transit agreement. We don't think we have to pay that rate even if we owe that money, even if we have to pay for the transiting. So, clearly, I'm having difficulty remembering exactly what your question was. hang on here. I think maybe I wrote a note down on it. I understand the duration of the contract. What else did you want me to address, Commissioner Hanson?
Well, you probably haven't written down because I've only been thinking it. So, however, just following up with Ms. Moore's statements, does not a series of your clients' payments for those monthly billings, doesn't that establish that relationship exists? And if go ahead.
I'm going to answer that. I have some information on why and what they were doing that's been relayed to me, but I don't want to get in a situation I'm testifying, so I'm going to just testify generally what you see in this industry, and I think everybody has seen here. And that is often what they'll do is you see it on interconnection agreements, you see it on all types of contracts once they expire. People will pay under old rates subject to true-up. So I think when you have a standard in an industry where people pay under old rates subject to true-up or subject to further investigation or subject to renegotiation, that it's very difficult for you to just make the assumption that, oh, that payment means that they were in agreement. It happens all the time when you're exchanging interconnection agreements, that you're doing that and you're making payments under old rates or under old agreements subject to true-up. And I think this commission has seen that over and over and over again. Now, if that wasn't true in this industry, that would be a much better argument. But I think just given how this industry progresses, I don't think you can rely on that. And I think the evidence when Altel says, hey, this is going on too long, we're just going to stop paying you until we get this figured out, I think that sends a pretty clear signal as that's what was going on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Wieczorek and Ms. Moore.
Other questions by commissioners or advisors? Hearing none, any comments or action?
Mr. Chairman, I'm really struggling with this. I am on the cusp of supporting the motion by Kennebec, and I just can't quite. I don't know if it's in ounces or pounds, but I feel like I'm an ounce away from that. But I just have enough of a question in the back of my mind, and that I just don't feel that it's appropriate to do that. So I'll prefer to listen to what you folks have to say before anybody makes a motion.
I will make a motion to deny the motion for summary judgment. I do think some issues of fact have been raised. It may be that the rate issue or that the Quest issue may be side issues or that they might be red herrings, but I just am not completely convinced of that. And in the absence of being 100% there, I think probably just safest to move forward. Motion has been made. Is there any discussion on the motion other than what I already have already done? Yes, Commissioner.
No, I agree with Ms. Moore and greatly, but I just think that the statement of law says that if everything is in order and there's no genuine issue, then they should order a summary judgment. And I just think that there's too many questions, especially with the Quest issue. That seems to really glare in my mind.
Any further comments on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johns votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much to the parties. Next up, telecom item number 3 is TC08-122. This deals with Cheyenne River Sioux Telephone, Tribe Telephone Authority, and the request for arbitration pursuant to the Telecom Act of 96 to resolve issues relating to an interconnection agreement with Altel. And the question before the commission today is, shall it approve the joint stipulation and proposed procedural schedule? Which party would like to address this first? Ms. Northrup?
Good morning, Margo Northrup on behalf of CRST. I have provided a joint stipulation and proposed procedural schedule on behalf of both of the parties. There is one minor change that we would like to make in paragraph 3A. We have agreed to change that date that says June 22nd to June 24th, and we would ask that you approve this stipulation.
And Talbot Wieczorek, on behalf of Altel, I agree with the changes set forth by Ms. Northrup. We're trying to work through a couple issues and maybe narrow some testimony.
Any comments by Mr. Thurber, Ms. Kramer?
This is Karen Kramer from staff, and we would recommend approving the joint stipulation and the proposed procedural schedule.
One presumes you don't have any problem with the suggested change from the 22nd to the 24th?
That is fine. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Any questions? Hearing none, any comments or action? I would move that the commission approve the joint stipulation and proposed procedural schedule as verbally amended this morning. Motion has been made. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks. Telecom item 4 is TC09-001. Deals with Midstate Telecom and the request for an extension of an exemption from developing company-specific cost-based rates. And the question for the commission today is, shall it grant the motion for temporary approval of switched access rates, Mid-States, Mid-State Telecom? Ms. Northrup?
Good morning, Commissioners. Margo Northrup on behalf of Mid-State Telecom. Just by way of history, on March 2nd of 2009, Mid-State did file a request for extension of time from developing company-specific cost-based switched access rates based in part by a settlement stipulation reached with staff in April of 2006. In that petition, they asked for an extension until 6 months after the rules had been made in the current pending rulemaking docket. After filing that petition, we did reach a settlement stipulation with staff that would allow an extension for 3 months. Prior to this commission taking action on that settlement stipulation and joint motion for approval, Mid-Continent filed and was granted late filed intervention, and no action was taken on the settlement stipulation. Accordingly, out of abundance of caution, we are here today asking that you approve in the interim the rate that is currently on file. This rate is in the tariff, and we believe that based on the filed rate doctrine, that rate still stays into effect until there's further action. We believe that this is also in accordance with a prior commission ruling. I think SS Telecom and TCO 9-014 asked for a similar request, and we would request that you grant this rate during the interim. I think that Mid-Continent has filed some objections and asked for this rate to be stricken. I'll just comment on those briefly. I understand that that will be on a future commission action, and so what we've asked for in our motion is that the rate stay in effect until either this action is completed or until the rulemaking docket has been completed and we can do that cost study. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Northrup. Mid-Continent.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission. My name is Dave Gertis. I'm a lawyer from Pierre, and I represent Mid-Continent Communications in this docket. Mid-Continent opposes the motion for reasons previously stated in the SS Telecom docket, and for the reason that Mid-Continent has pending before the Commission now a motion to have an evidentiary hearing in the four dockets that really have the same issue in them. And that is the SS Telecom docket, TC09-014 in this docket, and then the next two dockets on the commission agenda, RC Communications, which is TC09-022, and the Northern Valley docket, which is docket TC09-031. Mid-Continent believes that all CLECs are created equal, so to speak, and that it's improper to do anything other than require in the interim that this that Mid-State revert to the incumbent rate until such time as this matter can be heard in full and all evidence on the issue submitted to the Commission.
Thanks, Mr. Gertis. Staff.
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff, and staff would recommend granting the motion for temporary approval of the switched access rate. The Commission-ordered tariff is in place until it orders a new rate, and so even if a default rate is what would go into effect here, that is, continues to be the commission rate. Thank you.
Ms. Northrup, did you want any rebuttal?
Just briefly, I mean, as far as the motion for evidentiary hearing, I understand that that will be on a future docket. I think that we're just hoping that we can maintain the status quo and so that we actually have an order so there will be no confusion during the interim of this matter. And we believe that that is in the case with the filed rate doctrine, but we would also like to see a commission order that would order the same. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Hearing none, any comments or action? Yeah, go ahead.
I am actually conflicted on this. I'm I know that in the previous case, we decided that that the rate was frozen. But as I read it and reread it, I don't know how I may have missed the. My challenge is I want to be consistent at the same time as a commission. And as I read this, it does state that the rate freeze period has concluded. Once the rate freeze has concluded, obviously that it has ended. And now I'm at a juncture where I'm believing that it's that we have a situation where in one docket we made a decision that the rate was frozen, because it does state that it's frozen until April 7th, 2009, and then it states that once the rate freeze period has concluded, that Mid-State shall request an additional extension or file to update its, which they're doing now. And I'm curious what Ms. Wiest might be able to offer in that area for me.
Yes, this is Relaine.
Which side of the river do I swim to?
I recommend that the commission grant the temporary approval of the switched access rates. I think that the statement in the settlement agreement is that Mid-State has done what it was supposed to do once the rate freeze period has concluded, they shall request an additional extension or file to update. And I think that's consistent with that. And I don't think there's any problem with the commission granting that temporary approval. And it certainly could be that they don't need temporary approval, but just to make sure that no party contests any switched access rates during this time period, I recommend that the commission grant it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions? Hearing none, any comments or action? I would move that the commission grant the motion for temporary approval of switched access rates. Any discussion on the motion? I would just note that, again, I don't think this is necessary at all, but as has been said in an abundance of caution, I think it's the safest thing to do. Any further discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks. Proceed to a similar case, telecom item number 5, TC09-0022. This deals with RC Communications, and the question for the commission today is, again, shall it grant the motion for temporary approval of switched access rates? Ms. Northrup.
Thank you. Good morning. Margot Northrup on behalf of RC Communications Incorporated. I will echo the arguments that I made earlier for Mid-State. However, I do think I need to point out that there is one slight distinction in this case. RC's settlement stipulation had actually expired prior to the time that they had filed this motion. I think that was just a mistake on behalf of RC. They didn't realize that it had expired after they had been contacted by staff. They filed the extension. But I still think that with the filed rate doctrine, their rate also stays in place, and we would request an order to that effect until either this matter has been concluded or till the rulemaking docket has been concluded. Thank you.
Thank you. Mid-Continent is a party. Mid-Continent.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, on behalf of Mid-Continent, I would Mid-Continent takes the position that this motion should be denied upon the same grounds and for the same reasons that I mentioned in the previous docket.
Thanks very much. Staff?
This is Karen Kramer from staff, and staff's recommendation would be the same as in 009, which is to grant the motion for temporary approval of the switched access rate.
Thanks, Ms. Kramer. Any questions for any party? I'm waiving your rebuttal, Ms. Northrup. Hearing no questions, or is there any action?
I'll move in TC09-022 that the commission grant the motion for temporary approval of switched access rates, and just echo my sentiment that I really don't think it's necessary, but rates could go up rather than down after a freeze period is concluded. But that's my motion.
Any discussion on the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Telecom item, thanks to the parties. Telecom item number 6 is TC09-031. Third verse is a little bit different than the others. This deals with Northern Valley Communications for an extension from exemption of developing company-specific cost-based rates. But the first question for the commissioner today is, shall it grant intervention? I believe two parties have filed relatively recently, Quest and Mid-Continent. We'll hear first from Quest. Are we coming through okay on your end, Mr. Welk?
Yes, Mr. Johnson.
Okay, go ahead. Proceed.
We have our petition is been filed after the intervention deadline, but we do not believe that there's been any prejudice, and that under the South Dakota rules of administrative procedures and this commission's own rules, because Quest is a purchaser of these services, we have a direct and pecuniary interest, and that we want to become a party in this case. And so when I read the objection by Northern Valley, I really don't believe that they've shown that we would be in any way prejudicing the docket, and they certainly haven't denied our pecuniary interest in the docket. So for those reasons, we'd ask to be admitted as a party.
Thank you, Mr. Welk. We'll also ask to hear Mid-Continent's comments. Also filing for party status.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, Dave Gerdes representing Mid-Continent Communications, and Mid-Continent seeks intervention upon the same grounds and for the same reasons that it was given party status in the two previous dockets and also the SS Telecom docket. Mid-Continent competes with Northern Valley Communications in the Aberdeen Exchange and therefore has a pecuniary interest in this docket. I do not recall, but I believe Mid-Continent's petition was timely filed. But in any event, if it wasn't timely filed, we would submit that sufficient grounds under the commission's rules exist for the intervention.
Thank you, Mr. Gerdes. Northern Valley did file an objection. Mr. Kramer, comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim Kramer, I'm an attorney in Aberdeen. I represent Northern Valley. I'll take the MIDCO one first, and it was, in fact, timely filed so that the statutory basis for or the administrative rule basis for their intervention is different from the Quest one. In the MIDCO petition, they seek intervention status based on their claim that all CLECs should be treated the same and that they compete statewide and have a keen interest in what they say is robust and fair competition. I certainly agree that they have those interests, but first of all, we can treat CLECs differently. The feds do, and I think we can do the same here in South Dakota, so I don't think that's a reason for them to be granted intervention. With respect to their claim that they have a keen interest in robust and fair competition across the state, I think that's probably true, and if it were not for the rulemaking docket that is sitting out there that specifically addresses these concerns, it would probably be appropriate to allow them to intervene in this case. But the interests that they want to assert are more properly asserted in that rulemaking docket, and therefore I would ask that their petition to intervene be denied. With respect to the Quest motion, the rules are fairly specific. They are granted the right to intervene if they do not unduly prejudice the rights of other parties, and the denial is not detrimental to the public interest. In this case, again, Northern Valley would be prejudiced because of the additional time, cost, and expense involved in responding to Quest being in this docket. And certainly it would not be detrimental to the public interest to deny their petition because, again, the interest that they are trying to assert, the claims they're trying to raise are more properly asserted in the rulemaking docket. And all Northern Valley is asking in this case is simply to extend their current rates until the rulemaking docket is completed So anything that would be asserted by either Midco or Quest in this docket are properly asserted in the rulemaking docket, so therefore I would ask that Quest's motion would also be denied.
Thank you, Mr. Kramer. Staff comments?
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer of staff. Staff would not disagree with Northern Valley regarding Midco and Quest, that their arguments are probably best heard in Midco's switched access docket and in the rulemaking docket. However, the hurdle is very low for intervention, and therefore staff would recommend granting intervention to Midcontinent and to Quest, and while Quest filing is late filed, it's not by many days, and really nothing has happened in that interim anyway. So staff would recommend granting intervention.
Thanks, Ms. Kramer. Questions? I'd have one. Mr. Kramer, Midcontinent and Quest both pay these switched access rates. Isn't that a pretty clear pecuniary interest?
Sure, I wouldn't deny that.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Hearing none, any comments or action?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move that the Commission grant intervention to Quest and Midcontinent.
Motion has been made. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Both motions carry 3-0. Next question is, on this particular docket, shall the Commission grant the motion for temporary approval of switched access rates? Mr. Kramer and Northern Valley, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would hate to not adopt the eloquent argument of Margo Northrup, because she won in the prior two documents. I'll just adopt her same arguments and the reasons that she expressed, and for the reasons the Commission agreed in the prior two documents, I would ask that this motion be granted.
Thank you, Mr. Kramer. We'll look toward Quest. Mr. Welk, any comments?
No, we don't have any objection based on the same reasons that the Commission granted the temporary request on the other two docs.
Thank you, Mr. Welk. Midcontinent, Mr. Gerdes?
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, on behalf of Midcontinent, Dave Gerdes, to be consistent, Midcontinent would oppose the motion as it has done in the two previous dockets and also in the SS Telecom docket.
Thank you, Mr. Gerdes. Staff?
Thank you. Staff would recommend granting the motion for temporary approval of the switched access rate for the same reasons we've given before.
Thank you. Any questions for any party? Hearing none, any action?
Mr. Chairman, we'll move that the Commission grant the motion for temporary approval of the switched access rates.
Motion has been made. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0.
I just want to say that I'm more partial to the attorney Paul Kramer than Mr. Jim Kramer, Karen Kramer, but no prejudice in that.
Okay. Thanks, Commissioner. Telecommand number 7 is TC09-032. This deals with a filing for approval of a Type 2 wireless interconnection agreement between Quest and Standing Rock Telecommunications. The question for the Commissioner today is, shall it approve that agreement? We'll look toward either party to make comments. Hearing none, staff.
Thank you. This is Kara Semler for staff. The agreement was properly filed and executed. It doesn't appear to contain discriminatory language. No comments were filed. Staff recommends approval.
Any questions? Hearing none, any action? I'll move that the Commission approve the agreement. Is any discussion on the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Telecom item number 8 is TC09-041. This is a matter of the filing for approval of a resale agreement between Quest and NSW Telecom. Today, shall the Commission disapprove the agreement and dismiss the docket? Or in the alternative, how shall the Commission proceed? We'll hear from Quest Corporation or NSW first. Hearing nothing, Ms. Semler?
Thank you. Staff recommends denying this agreement. NSW Telecom, Inc. does not have certificate of authority to provide services in South Dakota, and staff simply recommends denial.
Any questions? I'd have one. Ms. Sumner, would it be more, you know, there isn't anything in our rules or law that says if you don't have a COA that you're not allowed to enter into this sort of an agreement. Would it make more sense for the commission to approve this agreement, but, you know, subject to NSW getting a COA?
Certainly. I did have some telephone correspondence with a representative from NSW Telecom, and they do intend to serve in South Dakota and do want to, and thought that with this agreement, I think they could. So I think the order should be pretty explicit. But certainly, I don't see anything wrong with such a condition.
That just seems like perhaps more legally defensible action for the commission to take. Other questions? Hearing none, comments or action?
Go ahead. I was just going to, in TC09-041, I'm going to motion to deny the agreement between Quest and NSW Telecom because NSW has no COA at the current time.
Okay. Any comments on the pending motion? You know, this is probably a flawed analogy. Well, I'm sure it is. All of my analogies are pretty flawed. But the way I viewed it is, you know, lots of times to enter into a business, you need governmental approval. You know, you can't run a restaurant without the Department of Health. But I can enter into an agreement to lease your restaurant facility. Now, I can't open those doors until I get governmental approval. But that doesn't necessarily mean that agreement, you know, that the health department has any right to say that agreement can't go forward. Now, it's a little bit different because we do have the obligation to approve these sort of agreements. But to me, I think we can probably approve the agreement and say, but you can't offer any service until you get a COA. And if we make that explicit, I think that's probably going to be exactly where I want to go. So I just wanted to provide my rationale for voting against the pending motion. Any other comments?
Mr. Chairman, I thought you were going to give us an analogy with a transmission in a vehicle that goes awry.
No, that's still too far tender a wound for me to joke about. Any other comments on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes no. Motion carries 2-1. With that, we'll proceed back toward the front of our agenda. Electric item number one, we're actually taking up this afternoon at 1:30, which brings us to electric item number two, EL08-034. This is Basin Electric Power Cooperative, and they're filing regarding the notification of intent to build an energy conversion facility. But the question today just deals with a timing request made by Basin, and at this time we'll look at the applicant, look to the applicant.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm Casey Jacobson on behalf of Basin Electric Power Cooperative. And as you are probably aware, in the energy siting rules, Chapter 2010-2239 provides that upon the filing of an application, an applicant shall also file all data, exhibits, and related testimony. And our request here today relates to the last part of that rule, the related testimony. And our request is to file that upon or after the application is filed, after the intervention deadline, once the parties are all identified. We think this would probably be a bit more fruitful exercise once the issues are identified, once we know who the parties are, if there is intervention to file this testimony after the application.
Thanks, Ms. Jacobson. Any interveners wish to make any comment on this motion? Hearing none, we'll look towards staff for their comment.
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff. You may recall that something very similar was done in a docket about a year ago. That matter actually never was filed, and so there's no order out there to look to. And staff would agree to granting Basin's request so long as the company, and they were before, so I assume they will be here also, is willing to extend that 60 days at the end if it's needed by staff, because by not filing testimony and data and exhibits, that takes 60 days from us. in reviewing this matter, and so the 1 year becomes shortened by that much. And so that would be staff's only request, is an acknowledgement by the company that they would be willing to extend that should that those days be needed.
Before going any further, we'll look to Basin to see Ms. Jacobson. Does your client have any comments on staff request?
We have no issues with that request. That's fine.
So Basin would acknowledge a willingness to extend the deadline by 60 days if requested by staff?
Yes, that's okay. Correct.
Great. Any questions?
Can I ask one?
Yes, Mr. Smith.
Would it be, and I think I went over this with Mr. Stuck in the NextGen case, but, I mean, it's not your intention to not file the typical very thorough and very, I guess textually complete application and all supporting exhibits. All you're suggesting not immediately filing is just the usual testimony, which usually says nothing more than I'm the person that prepared that portion of the application. Is that the intention?
That's correct. I think at this time, if we were to file the testimony with the application, it would just be more a Q&A of what's in the application. So after the intervention deadline, once the parties are identified, the issues are narrowed down, we would file that pre-filed testimony. Now, I can't imagine that we would have any exhibits in the pre-filed testimony that would not be included with the application. So to answer your question, definitely, we intend to submit an application that's more than complete with all the law and rules provided in the Siting Act.
Other questions, commissioners or advisors? Hearing none, any comments or action?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move that the commission grant Basin's request. Do we need to stipulate anything pertaining to the time frame?
Ms. Kramer shaking her head no.
I don't believe you need to make that a part of your motion. You could, but they've acknowledged it, and I believe that if it becomes necessary, they will do that.
Thank you. My motion then stands as stated.
Any comments on the pending motion? I would just note, I think this is very much in the public interest. I think that testimony gets far more focused on the issues in question if we wait until those issues are better known. Some people may have, or some entities or commission staff may have serious problems with this application. If that's the case, then I think we want that testimony to better reflect, better focus on those issues. So I agree with Commissioner Hansen's motion. Other comments? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen.
Aye.
Colbeck.
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks, Ms. Jacobson. With that, we'll proceed to electric item number 3, EL09-005. This is a filing made by Xcel for its economic development plan, both the 2008 and 2009. Mr. Wilcox, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. My name is Jim Wilcox. I work for Xcel Energy in South Dakota. Today I'm here just to present our annual economic development report for 2008 and our budget for 2009. I guess I would just simply request approval and stand by for questions.
Staff, comments.
This is Tim Binder for staff. We did review the 2008 expenditures. They did match with what was approved last year. And the 2009 budget or their plan for the next year is actually the same as 2008 that was approved. So staff does recommend the approval of the 2008 report and approval of the 2009 plan.
Thank you, Mr. Binder. Questions by commissioners or advisors? Mr. Wilcox, a question on 2008 actuals. $20,000 for the Sioux Falls Development Foundation website. I don't want to sound like a troglodyte. You know, the technology is not important, but, I mean, is this expenditure sort of the highest and best use of these dollars to help grow the economic base of the area?
Well, I think we thought so. I mean, that's why we made this investment. I could explain a little more about what the project is if you'd care to hear about that.
I think that'd be helpful.
The Sioux Falls Development Foundation had determined that a new website with some enhanced features would be useful. And these features include GIS capability, so for example, and some database querying functions. So For example, if you were a business person in some other state, you could go to their website and then select or query all of the buildings of, say, 10,000 square feet within a radius of 1 mile of 41st in Minnesota. That's an example. So this is a new feature that the Development Foundation has not had that other economic development organizations in similar sized communities apparently have, and so they feel like they needed to add this. So that last fall, the Development Foundation went out looking for sponsors because they didn't really have the money they needed to do this in their budget. And Xcel Energy and MidAmerican both stepped forward with contributions to help make this happen. And, you know, I guess I think it's a reasonable request from that standpoint. The other thought that I suppose crossed my mind, if you look at our budget and our actuals, a majority of the money that we invest is really aimed at rural economic development. Yet 85% of our customers and our revenues come from Sioux Falls. So I think already a disproportionate share of our economic development money is invested in rural, in our rural service territory. So I mean, I'm always happy to look for a project in Sioux Falls that we can justify working with because we are so rural, leaning rural in this budget.
So do you know the total cost of the project?
I understand about $30,000.
Okay.
Of which we contributed 20.
Okay. So this, you know, there's sort of a discretionary, I think the last few years have been about $31,000 for economic assistance. That 20 came out of that 31?
Yes.
So, and I should have pulled the previous years, I didn't, but give me an idea of, in the past, what sort of expenditures that, you know, discretionary $31,000 went to that would not have, that did not go there in 08?
Oh, I just struggle to remember specific projects, but we have supported computer programs with the Development Foundation in past years. I guess a year or the year before, the Development Foundation was in transition of new leadership, and they had hired a consultant to a selection firm to look, a search firm to search for a new executive director of the Development Foundation, and we were one of several contributors in that. So it was about the same size of investment in the previous year. So that's an example of the kinds of things we've done in the past.
Thanks, Mr. Wilcox. Other questions? Yeah, Commissioner Kolbeck.
I just have one. There's a couple of things on here that actually obviously involve electricity. Are these all monetary gains, or are these given in maybe lineman work time or trenching or anything like that? That's not included in
this. It's all in cash.
Okay.
Yes.
So there are other benefits to the community that maybe powered up or buried a line or any of donations like that to some of these projects?
We typically don't donate field personnel time.
Time material, I think.
Yeah, we don't normally do that. So we contribute cash. It's just a little easier.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Well, I'm not going to rehash the conversation we had last time, but I did raise with MidAmerican, and they're filing some what I would call big picture questions about, and they don't even particularly, I mean, have all that much to do with Xcel, but, and you've heard them before, Mr. Wilcox, so I'll just summarize them by saying, I don't know why we have this sort of a program in two of our six IOU service territories, but not in the other four. And it seems to me either the project is a smart and beneficial use of ratepayer dollars or it isn't. And so I'll just let you know that at some point, and I don't when, but when the sky clears a little bit on the workload, I mean, I think I'm probably going to be interested in having a discussion about what is the proper role for, you know, a commission in with these sort of economic development programs. Should we get toward six of six or should we get toward zero of six, or is this hybrid approach the continuing to be the right way? So I'll just make that comment. Other questions or comments? Hearing none, any action?
In EL, oops, I got to get the right one here. EL09-005, I motion that the commission approve the 2008 Economic Development Annual Report and the 2009 Economic Development Plan for Xcel Communications.
Any comments on the pending motions? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. The motions carry 3-0. Thanks, Mr. Wilcox. My intention would be to take a short break to allow us to set up the AV that's going to be necessary and to do a quick bathroom break, because I think this So unless there's any objection from the commissioners, we'll go ahead and take a seven-minute break. Thanks. For those of you listening on the Internet, we're going to go ahead and shut that down for 7 minutes, but we will be right back. Matt? And start back up. There is going to be a presentation for those of you listening on the Internet. We do have that presentation posted online under the docket number, which is GD09-001. So with that, we'll open up that docket. The question for the commission today is, how shall the commission proceed regarding Glacial Lakes Corn Processors' request? And we'll turn at this time to Glacial Lakes for any comments they would have to support their motion.
Thank you, Commissioners. My name is Jim Sire, Chief Executive Officer at Glacial Lakes Energy and Glacial Lakes Corn Processors of Watertown and Mina. We've got others from Glacial Lakes here, Kelly Dennison, our Chief Financial Officer, Roger Hansen, our Director of Commodities, does the corn purchasing, and then Mike Nealon, our Director of Finance. Also with us, we have three guest attendees who will speak briefly on our behalf. Just want to kind of go through, our agenda. We're going to give a background. We're going to talk a little bit about our current financial position. We're going to tell you about some of the actions we've taken. We're going to lay out our request and then further actions that we would be willing to take if our request were approved. And then also provide the three members of the public an opportunity to briefly speak. Glacial Lakes Corn Processors is a 4,200-member cooperative headquartered in Watertown, South Dakota, made up of farmers, producers, and investors of essentially all over the state, of primarily South Dakota investors. We are 100% owners of the ethanol plant in Watertown and west of Aberdeen near Mina. We also have a minority interest in the Redfield plant and a minority interest in the Granite Falls, Minnesota plant. The Watertown and Mina plants are buy and grind 72 million bushels of corn annually and produce 200 million gallons of ethanol. With that, I'll let Kelly go into the financial position and provide some background of why we're here.
Thank you. To provide some background to the chairman and the members of the commission, our fiscal year ended.
If we could have you get a little
closer. Our fiscal year ended August 31st, 2008, resulted in a reclassification of our long-term debt of $161 million from long-term liabilities to current liabilities due to a technicality and our external auditor's desire to present the most conservative presentation in accordance with GAAP. That technicality was we were in violation of our current loan covenants, which would allow our bank group to theoretically call that debt. Our status since August 31st is that the bank group has not called that debt in as current. They have not indicated in any way, shape, or form that they have the intention of doing so. We have continued to make our quarterly payments, and we are current on all principal and interest payments since August 31st. Therefore, because our balance sheet, under the interpretation of GAAP, presented that as a current liability, we were no longer in compliance with the statute that requires current assets to be greater than current liabilities in the financial statement presented with the grain buyer license application. As of May 31st, our balance sheet reflects positive net worth, which is one of the requirements of the statute, of $86.6 million, presented total assets and total liabilities. And our working capital, if you would consider our long-term debt as long-term debt, is positive $2 million. Page four, just to illustrate for the chairman and the commissioners, our long-term debt payments have been made every quarter, totaling $22.7 million since the issuance of the August 31st financials, and that takes us through June. A payment was made today, actually, 2009. We would also like to point out that our current financial position has improved recently, and through the quarter ended May 31st, 2009, our facilities generated working capital of $4 million.
Yeah, I just want to call out a few items on that page. This is page 5. If you go down the Watertown column, you can see that certainly the trends are, in our opinion, improving. We started out last December with a tough situation with contracted corn. We did honor all contracts. We took delivery of those contracts. We paid for them. And as we've worked our way through contracts, we've been able to generate positive cash flow. Just as a caveat, this is cash flow. It's not necessarily GAAP net income where you bring in the effects of depreciation. Mina was a little bit different. In March and April, we did not have contracts on the books over there, contracts for delivery. So in March and April, we were a little bit more subject to a tight basis, and we compete with the Pacific Northwest, the West Coast market up there because of the unit train loading facilities. There was field work going on in April, and certainly April is a challenge because of road conditions. March and April are challenges because of road conditions. So, but clearly you can see the Watertown improvement. Mina, there was some, there was a bit of a setback in March and April. May was a very, very strong month for us, and we were pleased by those results. $4 million in cash generated. Certainly, we do not consider May 1 month a trend, but we like some of what we're seeing in June already, and certainly are optimistic that June will be better for us as well. On a GAAP net income basis, just for the month of May, we did generate $500,000 in GAAP net income. So that was a bit of a nice presentation for us to come back and show some positive net income there. What actions have we taken?
Sorry to interrupt. I just want to make sure that if we start asking questions, of course, this presentation is on the Internet and this is being broadcast. If we ask any questions about your financials that are confidential, please make sure to let us know and we can, you know, ask them in a way that either doesn't violate any, you know, private financials or we can go ahead and shut down the Internet and we can go into a brief closed session to ask that question. But just a heads up. Go ahead.
Okay. Actions that we have taken last November. Our 4,200 shareholders recognize the importance of this co-op and in continuing the operations. We went to them with, and you can only do this through a cooperative. We went back to them through what's technically called a prepaid unit retain. We called it a capital call, 6 cents per share on 189 million shares. We collected $11.2 million from producers and investors and in the state of South Dakota. 42 of the 42 members did not pay, and their membership in the co-op was canceled. So
How many?
42 of 4,200.
Okay.
Really a phenomenal rate of response. Of course, again, just to reiterate that we feel that's indicative of the support we have for running these facilities the way we do.
Sorry to interrupt again. Can you talk to me about, so their membership was canceled. Were they bought out from their equity investments, or how did that work?
Actually, the legal term is not canceled, but they were their stock or ownership in the company was canceled. A certificate of interest was reissued to replace their stock. They would rank significantly lower down the line if the company was ever sold or liquidated. Essentially, the shareholders would be made whole first, and then the certificate holders would be behind shareholders.
So they didn't receive any return of their equity investment or anything. It was just sort of changing their priority, move them further down the list.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's provision in co-op law that we have that we can utilize this technique this tool when we go back for something such as a participation in the co-op through a unit retain or a pool fee or other tools that we have.
Sure, and I don't want to minimize the impressiveness of this $11 million capital call. I would just note that's a pretty significant financial harm that can befall folks who didn't respond to the capital call. Am I misrepresenting that?
You mean the recategorization of their shares? If they did not participate and they were a large investor, yes, they could, again, be moved down the ladder, if you will, to the point where they would rank behind those that paid the capital call.
Would they participate in dividend disbursement?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
The other actions that we've taken, financial strategies, our management team is developing a plan to restore our financial position, and we've continued to work on this. We have implemented new risk management strategies. We've implemented a new corn procurement strategy. This includes purchasing more corn directly from producers off the farm. And we believe this results, or we can document that this results in a lower cost to those of us or to the company. We've implemented operational enhancements in the form of cost reductions and or revenue enhancements, lower projects such as lower chemical usage, exploring oil separation, and getting to more competitive ethanol markets so that we can generate more revenue. Other actions that we are either taken or presently considering in the area of debt management, we continue to work with our bank group to address this issue. Right now, we're working on an amendment to waive the covenant violations that Kelly spoke to and or modify the covenants themselves to provide a little bit more flexibility for us. We've also been in contact with the National USDA office and Secretary Evans' office here in Pierre to look into programs to refinance a good portion of our long-term debt. What this would do for us is it would free up cash flow and increase our working capital and provide a government guarantee on our loan. With this, I guess I'll turn it over to Roger just to talk about the corn side of it. Roger Hansen, again, is our Director of Commodities. I just want to reiterate that we did honor all corn contracts last fall. We continue to honor contracts that are above market. During the height of our situation, I might digress here just a little bit. During the height of our situation last fall, we did make the statement to our shareholders and producers and both share member and non-member producers that if you see the gates locked, that means that the accounting department has calculated what our outstanding obligation of corn that we've purchased is, and we're not going to buy any more corn. So that's a clear indication that we've essentially run out of cash. We did not lock the gates when we were monitoring this situation. We were considering all of our obligations for contracted corn, corn that we had paid for, corn that we hadn't paid for, but that was delivered. And fortunately, the $11.2 million began coming in then, and we were able to work off of that. To this day, we're still operating on that $11.2 million and looking for the months like this past May, to return. So with that, here's Roger Hansen.
Good morning. Glacier Lakes Corn Processors needs to buy a percentage of 72 million bushels of corn for its two ethanol plants from producer owners and non-owner producers. You ask, why not all from grain companies? The reasons are many. First, we are a co-op owned by producers who expect us to buy from them. Next, if we price so much from a few, we drive up our own cost. We've made huge investments, have been made by our owners, South Dakota producers and investors, in grain storage, drying, and dumping facilities. This investment would not have been made if corn procurement was not planned for from producers. The impact on corn pricing in the trade area is huge, as Glacier Lakes Energy Corn Processors is the market. The West Coast export and feed market is slow and unpredictable. Any export markets outside of the state leaves very little value or cash left in the state. Most of the money or value added goes to where the processing of the grain is done. The money made by the grain companies exporting out of the state is probably only a dime or 20 cents. You know, this is something like maybe $7 million on 10% of the state's corn production. You ask, where does it go? When Glacier Lakes Corn Processors turn that South Dakota corn to ethanol, which is exported in cattle and hog feed, that's fed in the state, most of the processing value of our corn stays in South Dakota. And it goes to truckers who pay road taxes, utilities, property and sales taxes, labor, feeders, local businesses, and hopefully back to our South Dakota investors to turn it again. You know, I once heard that every dollar that stayed home went around seven times. You know, let's try to keep as many of those dollars here as we can. You know, producer corn will help us even out our corn price. The 3 to 6 cents basis change in our corn cost is huge to us. Thank you.
So what's our request? We believe it's in the best public interest to request a waiver of the statute, and we've requested a 12-month waiver. This will allow us adequate time to revise our loan covenants, to work with our lenders, to restructure our debt, to work on these USDA programs. Of course, we're learning that when we work with the USDA, an entity that large, nothing happens quickly, and certainly as part of our lending group, it's led by our loan group is led by First National Bank of Omaha, but there are 18 banks in that group, including Wall Street lenders, the former Merrill Lynch, GE Capital, some very, very large players. It's not a quick measure or action to get a group of 18 to do anything. It does take time. We would like the ability to, we're requesting the waiver to have the ability to continue to honor our future delivery commitments. We would also like to have a continued presence in the Watertown and Mina areas to provide competitive pricing and delivery options. And for that matter, we've kind of defined our corn draw areas from the Missouri River east to into Minnesota, and from Highway 14 on the south into southern North Dakota. So we draw from a significant area, and what we're seeing, particularly from this area, is cattle feeders coming to Mina to pick up distiller grains, with what's left over after the corn is ground, and they're bringing corn from this area to Mina and then going back with distillers. So certainly it's a key part of our strategy to continue to find the lowest cost corn possible. Do we need the elevators? Absolutely. We still need the elevators, though. We're not going to turn our backs on elevators. They help us through the times when the producers don't deliver, and we feel that that's a valuable partnership. We do want to continue to have this ability to go out and buy producer corn as well. Our plans to minimize the risk include the following, and I guess I'm not sure if we're proposing these. I don't know if the commission would come back and tell us how often, for instance, we will offer to settle our corn purchases more frequently. Currently, we do that weekly. If it were, and we know that it would reduce the exposure if we were to twice a week, three times a week. We would look toward the commission for direction there. We would agree to.
As I was looking through, and forgive me for interrupting you, but It just seems more appropriate for you to answer the question right now. I was looking at you, at that page and reading that as prior to your getting to it, trying to figure out, could you give me a 101, please, on how settling your corn purchases more frequently actually reduces your risk? I'm ignorant of that.
It reduces the risk because at any given point during the week, we continue to bring in trucks. I mean, we could have 100 trucks a day that come into Watertown and Mina. And a 1,000-bushel truck, that's $3,500. And we can continue as those days pile up, we hold that on our books as an outstanding obligation or a liability. So if we went to settling our payments and paying for corn more frequently, we would lower that outstanding obligation to the general public and to the producers.
I see. So the risk is not in a price fluctuation or anything like that. It's just the risk to the people who are owed money.
If the corn has been priced, that's correct. If the corn has not been priced, there would be both that would be there, the risk of the price risk plus the payment risk.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The price risk doesn't cut any particular direction. I mean, whereas the payment risk does. That minimizes risk to producers 100%. I mean, reduces risk. All of that movement is in the direction of reducing risk. The price risk is unpredictable. It could help or could hurt the producer.
That's correct.
Great, thanks.
I mean, it could go against us. It could go for us. I think typically what we would want to do under a resumed normal operation situation, and we're not quite there yet, but we would take down hedges that would minimize that risk to us if we had, the price later type contracts.
That when you say you settle your corn purchases more frequently, does that cut down on the voluntary credit sales then? Is that kind of what that would do?
Assuming that everything that we have not paid for is a credit sale, yes. Maybe more of a consumer type example. If I go to the gas pump and every time I fill up, I use a credit card. Well, it would be like if I went in and paid cash every time.
Sure.
And it would take us from a 7 to perhaps a 10-day delay down to something much, much less than that.
Okay. Thank you.
Sir, one last question. From your standpoint on your in terms of your cash flow management, are there any downsides with respect to what, if the commission were to lessen the frequency of your payments, do you have any cash management issues that being too extreme on that side could cause you? Because I have no idea what your revenue inputs are.
Good question.
And the timing of those.
Yeah, good question. We typically receive payment for our ethanol daily settlement. However, having said that, we sell ethanol in Mina on a unit train. So a unit train is a 110-car train of ethanol, and it takes us about 10 days to produce a unit train. The unit train, the advantage of using a unit train of ethanol or corn for that matter, or distiller's grains, is that Burlington Northern comes into that facility, they back up, they hook up to all 110 cars, and they make a dead run for the West Coast. So it's not like they have to stop that unit along the way and pick up more cars. It's a dedicated run to the Los Angeles or the populated areas. That tends to have some fluctuation in our cash flow. And administratively, I guess I won't deny the fact that if we were to have to pay daily, that would create some administrative issues, but I don't believe we would have proposed this if we felt that it would create any undue issues on our side. So, good question. Other measures that we have agreed to propose for the commission we would seek out additional bond coverage. Right now, I believe we're required approximately $500,000 at each location under the current program. We would go out and seek additional coverage beyond that and provide that. We could also provide an offer to provide more frequent and detailed reporting back to the staff at the PUC, essentially as frequently as you require. That would show what is our exposure or outstanding obligations at any given day of the week or any given week. Currently, I don't believe we provide any of that type of reporting. Now I would like to introduce three members from the public who will speak on our behalf. Marietta Lackness, a Hayti area producer and currently a shareholder. Tim Huber from the Hovind Selby area, a producer, and then Keith Haney, general manager of North Central Farmers Elevator in Ipswich. After that, I will be available for questions again. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you, Public Utilities Commission, for allowing time to voice my support for Glacial Lakes Corn Processors. As Jim said, I'm Marietta Lackness. I farm and ranch with my husband Nathan, his dad, and Nathan's brother and their spouses by Hayti. Since October of 2002, we have delivered 1,333,826 bushels of corn sold directly to Glacial Lakes. One-third of our corn is sold to Glacial Lakes and a couple of other ethanol plants. And we are paid extra by local elevators to deliver directly to Glacial Lakes corn that we sold to the elevator. Local elevators, I've really seen a change where they no longer see the plant as competition, which has narrowed our basis, but as a resource for their corn. Unit trains are not plentiful enough, and this cuts their transportation costs. Glacial Lakes is to be commended greatly for honoring all corn contracts. This is very important to keep the trust of us as producers, to minimize our stress, and continued selling of corn by producers to Glacial Lakes. This last winter, Glacial Lakes was the only place that would take corn for quite a span as the elevators were full. Our farm is 20 miles from Glacial Lakes. They have saved us truck, fuel, and labor expense as to market our corn profitably in the past. We have had to haul to ADM at Burr and Marshall, Minnesota, to Pipestone, Minnesota, Trent, South Dakota, and a feedlot by winter. We purchase the byproduct, wet distillers grain, for our cattle operation, which reduces our costs there. And as a producer and shareholder, we have purchased E85 vehicles to show our support. We did a lot of research before investing in ethanol plants. Times were tough. We are faced with low commodity prices and coming off of a couple years of recovery from flooding. We knew it meant borrowing money to invest. Those usually don't go together, borrowing to invest. But it was a risk to invest in ethanol versus land to diversify our dollars. Corn was $1.83 when Glacial Lakes opened in the fall of 2002. $2 was a common break-even to 15% profit point. We hope the dividend payouts would help us capture the $2 price level. Of our $120,000 original investment, we received back $221,000 in cash dividends, 185% payback on investment. With retained earnings added to this, it upped the return to over $500,000. A 428% possible return. Imagine how many times these returns turned over in our local economy in the Watertown, Hayti area. Plus, dividends from the elevators and co-ops have increased to producers due to Glacial Lakes helping their bottom line. We believe in acting on our convictions. Glacial Lakes is vital to our grain and livestock operation in our community. In 2006, we invested another $175,000. We wrote checks for $70,000 last November in the prepaid unit retained call. As recently as January of 2009, we purchased another 45,000 shares. Selling corn now is at profitable levels, meaning less or no dividends. A drop in prices will give us benefits on the shareholder side. We look at it as a risk management tool. We lost a crop 2 years in a row due to flooding. As our farm's finance manager, I talked with our family, our banker, and our equipment finance companies that it would take us 5 years to recover, which it did. We all worked together to make our operation profitable again. Glacial Lakes corn processors face their problems and have been diligently working to regain profitability. It takes time. I am asking you to grant Glacial Lakes corn processors a waiver. Thank you.
May I ask just one question before?
Sure.
Does the Keystone Pipeline go through your property?
No, it does not.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Morning. I'm Tim Huber. My family and I farm west of Holden. We're about 75, 80 miles from the Mina facility, and I hope that as a result of my testimony today that you would grant Glacial Lakes a waiver of their grain buyer's license. For years, we would put our corn on a truck, and sometimes I would drive that truck, and we would head west to Montana and Wyoming to deliver corn to dairies and feedlots out there. And that was simply because we were the weakest basis in the nation at that time, and still are relatively close to that. But the basis has changed now recently due to ethanol plants in South Dakota, and now it's a direct correlation as to what that basis level is based on the number of miles you are from a local ethanol plant. So as you go up and down 83, for example, as you get closer to Highway 12, which is closer to Mina, your basis will be narrower. That and the rail add to that basis. But as you come south, closer to Oneida, or go north, get into the area of the border, for example, the South Dakota-North Dakota border, that basis gets wider again. And it's basically all a function of your distance from the ethanol plant. And also, our corn no longer goes west because we're not competitive anymore. The weakest basis is north of us and south of us, so we can't put it on a truck and send it west. As the cost of production per acre of both corn and wheat hovers near $300 for in our operation, we believe the corn acres will continue to increase. And that's because competitively, wheat isn't competing in our operation. And I think we're seeing it in the last 2 years as you drive the countryside, you see more and more cornfields. And that's just going to continue, but that same continuing of that puts a real strain on the local rail system. And it's not unusual at all for us to sit in line for quite some time unloading, maybe getting two loads a day in. And I think any time you have a buyer such as Glacial Lakes in the system, it's going to help to alleviate some of those problems, not all of them, but some of them. They can competitively buy their feedstock during these weak basis periods and at the same time help alleviate the strain on the system. Now, Glacial Lakes is a basis buyer, and I'm a basis seller. And the narrower that basis is for me, the better I do. The wider that basis is for them, the better they do. But I think, you know, there's a little give and take in the system, and it works for both of us and can work to both our advantages. Now, as a producer, I also really appreciate your side of things. I appreciate that PUC monitors the financial status of those who buy grain from us. And we know that there can be a tremendous hardship on our part if there's financial insolvency. However, you know, after I've reviewed the data that I've seen, I would feel comfortable selling through Glacial Lakes at this time, and I really believe their cash flow and balance sheet strength is good enough that they could be granted this waiver. So thank you for your time and effort and consideration in this matter.
Mr. Hubert?
Yes.
Could you tell me approximately what percentage of your fuel costs have been reduced as a result of this? You say you used to drive to Montana.
Well, it isn't so much, you know, the one thing about going to Montana, we would price that. One of the reasons that worked is we would price that corn from our yard. So we were getting paid freight all the way out there. And once we lost that competitive advantage where they could buy the corn cheaper somewhere else, it really didn't matter. I just wasn't able to put it on a truck and make that work. So now it becomes a question of, as far as fuel cost, do I drive to Selby or Bowdell, which are rail facilities, or do I drive to Mina, which is another, you know, 50, 60 miles, depending on where you're going from.
Okay.
So fuel cost becomes by the mile type thing, but it's still our biggest cost is loading and sometimes sitting in line idling for, you know, that line has
sure.
to move. You sit in line idle for a day, and you could just as well have gone down the road. So,
all right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Huber, could I ask you one quick question? In terms of, you know, we've talked a little bit about the company, you know, speeding up its cash settlements. I guess as a producer selling to the company, do you have any thoughts or observations on that and what you see as a reasonable settlement period that the commission might approve? And maybe Ms. Lackness had a comment on that too. I don't know.
Yeah. For me, from a producer standpoint, what I like is consistency. If I'm delivering this week and I get my contract with them full, if I can be paid, you know, within a certain number of days and I know that payment is coming, well, I can work with that in my own cash flow. So for me, consistency is almost as important as the amount of time. Now, once you get, you know, probably beyond 2 weeks out, well, then you've kind of lost the consistency argument. But, you know, it's just a matter of knowing when I complete the contract, you know, are checks going to be drafted on the Monday coming back, or are they going to be drafted on a Friday? It's that consistency that really becomes important to me.
I guess I would address the getting paid once a week. It's becoming a norm for a lot of the elevators in the area too. It helps them deal with the volume that comes in there and the help that they have. And like I say, as long as a person knows ahead of time, and some change midstream or if they're busy, but if you've got that relationship with the ethanol plant or the elevator, I've had them call and say, you know, can we work on your stuff next week if we don't get it this week? And as long as, you know, and then it comes in return. I've also called up there and I said, you know, because of cash flow concerns, could I have the check today instead of waiting the week? And I found communication is so key, and so it works.
Commissioners, I'm Keith Haney, General Manager of North Central Farmers Elevator in Ipswich, South Dakota. I just want to clarify that I'm here on behalf of North Central Farmers Elevator, not the entire grain industry. Okay. And we have an outstanding relationship with Glacial Lakes Energy at Mina. We're a major supplier of corn to that facility. We also have a part ownership in that facility, and the payment history that Glacial Lakes has shown to us has just been flawless. They've done a very, very good job. We've got a great working relationship with them. and we got a lot of trust that we have in them. As you well know, that I was involved in the warehouse review committee work that the PUC wanted, and one of the things that came out of that was the bonding requirement or the grain buyer's license necessity for ethanol plants. And I think it's, as you well know, that, you know, your duty here is to protect the producer or the general public to make sure they get paid for their corn. And I think one of the things that that came out of that warehouse review committee was that bonding requirement. And probably that is more of importance than what some of the covenants or the financial requirements were, because, you know, if you're a bonding company and you're putting $1 million on the line, you're going to make doggone sure that that's a good investment to get that so there isn't a claim on the bond. And I think that that's something you have to really look at. And that was a lot of our discussion as far as, you know, whether or not the PUC and how much in depth they have to look at financial records versus having the bond requirements substantial enough so the bonding company takes it serious enough that they're going to make doggone sure that they don't put their bond money at risk. In this case, $1 million is a pretty good size a bonding requirement, and I think that in itself should give you assurance that that the producers dealing with Glacial Lakes Energy will be well treated. You know, I think it is important to look at this this industry. You know that it's gone through some challenges, and right now this industry does not need additional costs. I don't think that there's a need for additional bonding requirements. I don't think that there's a need for faster payment. I know there were some comments made about elevators, getting to where they pay only once a week. But, you know, our general policy is we pay on demand, period. Just whenever somebody wants to get paid. If they want to get paid a load at a time, they can get paid a load at a time. You know, that I think you can set up any type of a payment structure you want to, but I don't think they really need additional interest costs right now. I don't think they need the extra cost of having to buy everything from an elevator instead of being able to buy it from producers, because every time it has to go through an elevator, there's an elevation charge, there's additional trucking charges, there's a lot of things that enter into it, and so I'd certainly support the request for the waiver of the financial requirements, the positive working capital requirement that the PUC has, and ask that you give them that waiver.
Thanks, Mr. Haney. Anything else?
It just seems like we've talked a little bit about this payment frequency, and I do want to just make a couple of points. As Ms. Lackness indicated, we do pay on demand as well, as Mr. Haney also indicated, and that is, you know, there's certain producers that want that security, and we will make payment on demand. But just to kind of maybe put some numbers to Mr. Smith, your question, I'll just focus on what we use in each plant, okay? Not necessarily what's delivered, but if you focus on what we use, we grind 100,000 bushels a day at $4, that's 400,000 a day. 7 days a week, that's $2.8 million that at a minimum could be at risk. Now, by the time we get the checks cut in the mail, get them delivered, you know, that might be another couple of 400,000 added on there. So, if we do pay, and I appreciate Mr. Haney's comments, but if we do pay twice a week, that would essentially cut that exposure in half. So that kind of, maybe that's a better example of what we would realize or what would be realized if there was a more frequent payment schedule. That's really all I have. If there are any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Mr. Chairman, I have one, if I may. If this is too confidential. Just I don't feel compelled to answer. In a, we would. But I'm trying to get a grasp of just the financial strength of your institutions here. And when I look on page 5 of your handout, I see the month of May of 2009 is an exceptional month compared to other months. Would you expect that to continue? I guess I'll end the question there.
You know, we've seen some things that have developed in June, during the month of June, Commissioner Hansen, that, you know, we're always going to be a little guarded in our optimism, but as Mr. Haney indicated, we've had some tough go. I mean, this has been a very difficult period for ethanol, period. It doesn't matter which entity you're with. You know what does matter. You know, we have the lowest priced corn in the country in this part of the state. Well, South Dakota does, and so we have an advantage over plants in Iowa and Minnesota here from a corn cost perspective. We lose some of that advantage in terms of freight, because essentially where they might have two railroads to utilize, we essentially have one at each one of these facilities, and everything does move out of these plants on rail. There's just a very smidgen of truck traffic that comes into Watertown. Otherwise, you know, 99.9% of what we do in Watertown and almost 100% of what we do in Mina goes out on rail. We would expect some of the similarities of what we saw in May, we would expect them to carry into June. And in addition, we are starting to see a little bit of widening of the corn bid and the ethanol bid out there. So, I mean, I would say that I'm cautiously optimistic that we are going to see that during the summer months. Will that carry over into the fall? I don't know. I mean, obviously, look, way back when this industry was built, and the state saw it that the industry should be built, they put in incentive programs and such, and as did the feds, to build the industry. Corn was selling at $1.60, $1.80, and we were getting $2.50, $2.60 for the ethanol. Now that's completely turned around. You know, corn's at 350-ish, and there were times when we were getting $1.50, $1.60 for ethanol. Well, that just really is a compression of the margins, and whereas 2006 and 2005, 2006 and part of 2007, when some of the returns that Ms. Lackness was talking about were created, those two were wide apart. Now they've kind of come together, and they just mirror each other. Now we're starting to see a little bit of them widening again, where it seems like ethanol doesn't know if it wants to follow corn or if it wants to follow gasoline.
Sure.
And so how long will that continue? I really don't know. I obviously, for the benefit of the industry and for the benefit of rural South Dakota, I would like to think that would widen and continue for some time in our approaching of the USDA, we believe, we have a strong belief that these ethanol plants are responsible for the prosperity in the rural areas. They're not only commanding a better price for corn, but as wheat and beans compete for those corn acres, it's kind of holding everything up there. So on the other hand, what will the industry look like a year from now, 5 years from now? I don't know. You know, we would like to think that there's room for some South Dakota-owned facilities like you have at Glacial Lakes, like you have at Redfield and Wentworth, and to some extent in the other areas. So maybe a long-winded answer to your question, but we're optimistic that we'll see some continue to see some improvement over the summer.
No, I recognize you need to be somewhat of a soothsayer to answer that question, but with your knowledge and experience, I was just curious what you would expect from your plant, not what you might see 5 years down the line. But I do very much appreciate the answer, and we'll end it with that. Thank you very much.
One other point. Maybe I might have missed this. I think it's on page 6. One of our strategies, and as we approach our bank group to cure this issue of covenant violations, one of the strategies we've put in front of them is a preferred stock offering. Certainly, and not everyone has the appetite for ethanol investments, but we do believe that there are folks still out there that if they were to step ahead of the normal stockholder, be given the opportunity to step ahead of the normal stockholder right now and help us through this difficult time, and there's, maybe a bit of hedging that goes on here. If there's a good crop, there might be an appetite for investors to step up again and provide some, or to subscribe to some form of a preferred stock offering. We have put that in front of our bank. We have our legal firm working on that. Would that be an offering, perhaps as much as $10 million in additional equity that would come into the balance sheet and continue to allow us to operate? These are very, very cash and capital-intensive business. They're very large operations. When you just kind of think about the volume of dollars that come in and go out, So a $10 million offering of preferred stock would be a nice give us a lot more flexibility in our operations.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I think one final question. Did you say it was 6 cents per share?
6 cents per share was our capital call last November. Yes.
So I'm looking at page 3, where the working capital is indicated at a little under $2 million. And then, you compare that on page 5, where you show cash flow generations month to month at the plants. Kind of walk me through how would you handle, $2 million looks like a couple of bad months. So maybe 3 bad months. If August and September were so bad that working capital began to get towards zero, walk the commission through what you would do to deal with that situation.
I'll bring up our Director of Finance, Mike Nealon. He also does some of the forecasting. Mike? I don't know, Mike, do you recall what our working capital was last fall during some of those periods?
I don't remember. I can pull it up on the computer, but that's in term from a cash standpoint. Yeah, we'd be going very much kind of a hand-to-mouth type of situation. In that case, we would look at, are there ways to generate more revenue? Are we looking at ways to cut expenses at that point? We all during this process looked at, from our own interest, how best do we operate to either maximize cash or minimize the cash outflow? And just like any other business, there's a point where you operate and a point where you make some other choices. And so in that case, we look what are our options on a very frequent basis, even looking at production level on a weekly basis, where is it the most profitable run? Does it make sense to slow down a little bit, use a little bit less, be a little more efficient on your usage? And so and that's basically where we were last fall before the capital call, from a resource standpoint, looking at those decisions on a very frequent basis.
Yeah, we were meeting daily there for a while before we were able to break escrow on the $11.2 million we were looking at the corn that we had purchased at that point. And we fully recognize that if we leave anybody in the public hanging with non-payment or even for that matter not honoring contracts, we really only have one shot at this. That's going to require us to essentially change our operation. We would lose the confidence in the public of the trust of the public and our producers. So we were meeting daily every morning to, you know, where are we at with the corn we've got in the plant. And again, that's kind of the basis for the statement that we made to the at the shareholder meeting on November 8th, that if you see the gates locked, that means we've taken all the corn that we can pay for, and we aren't going to take any more corn. We'd have to go into a shutdown mode or a slowdown mode at that point, and you know, perhaps even a shutdown like some plants have done for a period of time until we can find additional equity. I wouldn't see that approach changing at all.
So if, I mean, if that is how you're going to do business, then the risk would be on the folks who, you know, are part of members of the cooperative and not the producers. You're saying once you've got cash flow concerns, you're not going to bring corn in-house that you can't pay for. Is that right?
That's correct. That's been our practice in the past, and we would forward that indefinitely. And you are correct that, you know, at that point, you know, you have the shareholders that have this investment and that's not operating, and essentially their investment is at risk. And, you know, what are our options then? We can either work with our lender to provide more flexibility, if you will, or essentially sell the facilities to somebody else. And in that case, the shareholders are at risk.
How much exposure do you have, you know, at this time to above market contracts for corn?
Oh, we've you've got that number.
As of this point in time.
Let's wait till you get to the mic. Sorry, millions are listening on the internet. So,
as of this point in time, we still have future commitments to deliver corn out. I think the latest is through 2010 that were made a year ago for high-priced corn. So you're talking $6.50, $7 corn. But that total is approximately $2.4 million. And that's all the way out through 2010. So they're very small bushels.
Okay, so walk me through as in general terms. I don't need exact numbers, but give me an idea of how much of the corn that you're processing in any given, you know, week in the short term is committed to contracts that are above market, and then, I mean, are all of these contracts 2010? I mean, my presumption would be their terms would vary. Is that right?
Commissioner Johnson, you're going to have a little in every month, and there's certain months that are heavier than other months. January.
But are we talking 1%, 10%, 20%? I mean, give me a ballpark idea here of the exposure.
We've got the numbers in bushels here, and put my glasses on. But for instance, in the current month, we'd have 190,000 bushels. In July, we have 560,000 bushels. In October, 380.
Okay, now, sorry to interrupt, but I mean, okay, so we can talk about 560,000 bushels, but I mean, generally, are these at five? Are these at six? Is this at 650? I mean, that, because 560 at $6 gets to be, you know, over $3 million.
To my recollection, it seems like we've worked our way through the very high contracts. We're down in the mid fours and maybe approaching five on certain months. But to my recollection, we don't have the number on this particular sheet here. But to my recollection, January was a very tough month for us, and we got through those. And it seemed like the cost for January was in that five range. Or real close to five. And as you might imagine, I mean, within that number, there's all kinds of different levels. And then when I say 560,000 bushels, that's a month where we take in or in consume 3 million bushels. That's essentially what we consume on a monthly basis.
To be specific on the month of July, Chairman, we have 560,000 bushels with a price tag of $1.4 million. So it's not, and as we move forward, these bushels decrease to like 25,000 in August, none in September, and the rest aren't priced.
And presumably the average cost that was contracted for goes down somewhat too. Is that right?
That's correct. I mean, there are certain times, I mean, the all-time high, or the high in the last past, the past 12 months was roughly July 1st of 2009. So anybody who contracted in for July of this year, perhaps, or contracted in that time would be, at that $6-$7 range. But yeah, as time goes on, we've seen those numbers come down.
So what was that? If the working capital is now at $2 million, May was, as you mentioned, a really good month, $4 million positive cash flow month. So what was the cash flow looking like April, at the end of April? Working capital, sorry.
Working capital, and again, some of this cash flow is going to be not yet received. Working capital, Mike, I don't know if you can bring that up. Mike's got his computer here. We're going to have him bring that up. It's a similar question to the one that I had asked him earlier about last fall. Where were we at? And it's a valid question.
Well, while he's looking, we can certainly see if there are questions. Commissioner Kolbach.
Yeah, I can ask. Just to give me an idea, who is? Go ahead, Mike, if you want to just answer. As long as we're on it.
I mean, our network working capital for at the end of April was a similar month in terms of cash. When we talk about cash generated, that's before any other debt service, and so. And so you're gonna have that in terms of also from cash generation. That's just income add back your non-cash items on the working capital. You're paying bills. You're using cash for some other resources. And we do have other. We have as part of our liabilities, we have an amount with our broker for some capital or for some margin deposits. And so that we're still showing that as a current liability. And so, from that aspect, our working capital has been for the last couple of months just below the. I got in my mind $1.5 million. I don't have that combined number on my computer, but that's what we're at as of the end of April. From a GAAP working capital standpoint.
Yeah, the point Mike made is a good one. In order to service our debt. With our lenders, it's going to take about $2.2 million in cash generated every month. So our quarterly payments are approximately $6.5 to $6.6 million for both facilities. It's a bit of a moving target. We generated $4 million, but when you factor in that we did make a payment in June for $6.6 million, it may not show that, okay, now that $4 million's in the working capital. It may not fully show that because we continue to make payments on our debt. And it's not in a monthly format, but, again, the quarterly, just 6.6 divided by 3 is $2.2 million a month that we have to generate or we'll go down even further.
Thanks. Commissioner?
I guess my question goes to who's exposed with these corn sales. Obviously, members and non-members can sell you corn, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So is there a certain percentage that you could tell me? How many do you do? 90% of your business, people are members of that. Is there 10%? Do you have any numbers like that?
We purchase more corn from elevators in Mina than we do in Watertown. I guess I'd just rather not divulge that right now, but I can tell you that the percentage of exposure to the public would be higher in the Watertown area.
Yeah, again, just reassuring that in Mina, most of our exposure is actually to the country elevator. One thing is the plant's only been there for a year, so we're fairly new up there, so we haven't created a lot of relationships with producers. Most of our membership is probably in the Watertown area, not the Mina area. So, again, our membership deliveries happen larger in Watertown than they do in Minot.
Okay. As far as on your plans, you had some plans that you were going to bring to fruition. You asked for a 12-month waiver to be granted. Do you anticipate your plans and to be on solid ground before the 12 months, or are you fairly confident that you'll need another waiver?
No, I would hope by within the 12 months that we would have everything lined out and ready to go. In fact, I would say that it's our internal drive to get things resolved much, much sooner than that. Whether we're working with the USDA or with the bank group, things tend to move slow among those two groups. Particularly within the bank group, it seems like everything we have to get their approval. I acknowledge that we've built some cushion into that period. If the commission sees it fit to pull that back, we would be agreeable to do that. We've got our fiscal year end is August 31st. We will undergo audit at that point. It would be our intent to try to have the work with the bank done before the end of our fiscal year. We would see later in the year this fall going out with this preferred stock offering, and that would be an additional, as I've indicated, as much as $10 million coming in. That's kind of where we're at. Again, kind of build some room in there for delays.
Okay. On your plans to minimize risk, we'll settle our corn purchases more frequently and also seek additional bond coverage. I guess in my mind, one or the other would be a good solution. How much bond coverage are you comfortable with? In additional bond coverage, are you comfortable with three?
I think we've talked about as much as $1 million per location, so we'd essentially double if we can. I mean, we haven't tried this yet, but if we can, we haven't surveyed the market, but we'd essentially try to double what we've got out there, with additional over and above what the requirement is.
Sure. Now, if it couldn't be secured, you are in a position to settle corn purchases more frequently, though, correct?
Yes.
Okay. I'll hand it over to the chairman again. Thank you.
Okay. I know Commissioner Colbeck asked a specific question you didn't necessarily want to answer, particularly given the differences between the two plants about where the corn comes from, but maybe we can speak in generalities. Taking both of them together, give me an idea of how much generally would come from an elevator versus non-owner producers versus cooperative member producers. Again, I think the question is a really good one. Where does this exposure lie on the producer side?
Let me provide just a little bit of background first. I mean, we recognize that as we've grown, I mean, the Watertown facility was originally a 50 million gallon facility, and it was doubled in 2007 to 100 million gallons. So the demand for corn doubled as well. The Mina facility was not there before, so now you've got another 100 million gallon facility. So you've essentially gone from a plant or a membership, a ownership group that needed to deliver 18 million bushels to one that needs to deliver as part of its obligation to the co-op 72 million bushels. And the way a co-op structured, if that corn cannot be delivered, a pool fee is charged and paid the investor, shareholder, and then we go out to the elevators and find the corn for them. The membership makeup of this organization is primarily and has been in that Watertown area, in that eastern part of South Dakota. We have had conversations on our board of directors that at some point we'd like to diversify that to a greater extent. Would the preferred stock offering give us that opportunity? We believe it would. And it would be our intent to try to balance that out a little bit better. Also, when we brought Roger back to work for us, he was with an ethanol plant in North Dakota for a short period of time. When we brought him back as an employee, the specific strategy was to get him out into the country and buying corn, more corn directly. We communicated that to a good majority of our elevators that we just, in order to survive, we need to have access to lower cost corn. That is our major input, and I like to say anytime you buy 72 million of something, you better be on target, because that's where, you know, even a penny can be a huge number. The intent of that strategy would be to lighten up that dependence, or get to that corn first, lighten up that dependence on the elevators. And again, I'm going to say that we do need the elevators. There's no question about it. But we also need the ability to go directly and get at the lower cost corn. As a general goal, we'd like to be in the 50 to 60% range, where we buy, 50 to 60% of it from the producer and the other portion from the elevators. Will we ever get there in the MINA area? I don't know. I mean, there's just some things about both areas that might work in one area but not in the other. So we've kind of looked at it as a blended 50 to 60% for both entities. Currently, I can say that we're quite a ways below that.
Thanks. If there are other questions for these folks, great. Otherwise, we can look to Mr. Milhoff or Ms. Semler or anybody on staff who wants to make a comment, and we can always come back to. Staff, comments.
This is Jim Milhoff from staff. I think the folks here from Glacial Lakes and their witnesses that they brought have made an awful lot of good points. Number one of them being that they've demonstrated in the past that they've been very responsible in their corn procurement and their payment. The only concern I would have from a producer protection standpoint, which is what I think we're here for, is to make sure that the producers don't get burned at the end of the day, is the voluntary credit sale contracts. In the past, and in the wake of the Verisun Chapter 11 filing, every bushel of corn that was ever delivered was paid for, with the exception of some bushels that came in on voluntary credit sale contracts. And those were the only producers who were harmed as a result of that. And I think Verisun acted very responsibly as well. So that would be my main concern from a consumer protection standpoint. So the point that granting the waiver would allow them to make good on their future delivery contracts, I think that's important for producers. The growth of the ethanol industry has been good for producers in all, and taking all that into account, I would be inclined to recommend approval of a license, probably with that one stipulation with the voluntary credit sale contracts.
So, Mr. Milhoff, what is the stipulation with regard to VCS? Would it be that they could not enter into those?
That they would not be allowed to enter into new contracts until they brought their financial statement into compliance with the administrative rules.
Mr. Sire, any comments on that?
I guess I'm just looking for some, Jim, you mentioned voluntary credit sale. I just want to make sure we understand what that is per your definition. And then you also mentioned new contracts. So
okay.
I want to make sure that we're clear on what you're recommending.
Mr. Chair, when I say new contracts, I mean new voluntary credit sale contracts. And when I say voluntary credit sale, I'm referring to purchases of corn where payment is deferred beyond 30 days, which then makes it a credit situation where you're producers are extending credit, in which case the bond would not cover those purchases. And that's where the concern is from my standpoint.
So, Mr. Milhoff, I mean, most folks in production ag are pretty savvy operators. My feeling is that they understand they're extending credit to an elevator when they enter into a VCS. Some of them do that purposely because it fits their business model. It's something they want to do. Is a complete prohibition against VCS the right way to go? I mean, if the producer knows exactly what they're doing and still wants to enter into that, are we overreaching here a bit? Your thoughts?
Mr. Chairman, I don't necessarily think that we would be overreaching in making that prohibition. It is our responsibility, in my view, at the warehouse division, that we should be looking out for producers' interests and that they get paid for their corn. And history has showed us that, you know, in a recent similar situation, the only ones who were not paid were those who entered into those contracts. I understand that producers are savvy and they understand how business works. But on the other hand, when you grant a license to a certain extent, the division and the Public Utilities Commission also is signing off on that entity that they're good to go, that they're licensed and in good standing. And clearly we do have some issues here, although I think Glacial Lakes has behaved very responsibly and has kept the producers' interests at heart.
So walk me through, I mean, other than taxation reasons for wanting to defer payment, walk me through other reasons why VCS contracts would make sense for producers.
Well, the number one thing, like you stated, to defer payment into another tax year. Another one is just a speculation that the market will go up. I mean, if you do a deferred payment contract, you would set the price and defer the payment to a later date. You could also enter into a price later contract where you deliver the corn and the title passes and you agree that you won't price the corn until a later date. And there the speculation would be that corn prices would go up in the meantime.
So you really have two different flavors of the VCS, one really being deferred payment is the only real benefit to producer, the other being both a, you know, rolling the dice on commodity prices as well as deferring payment.
Correct.
Okay. Can you give us an idea of to what extent Glacial Lakes corn producers makes use of VCS contracts and to what extent one is the price set on that day as opposed to the price set at some point in the future?
Well, I just want to make a couple of points. First of all, I do respect Mr. Melhoff's opinion and really we want to continue to work with his folks. So I want to make sure that, you know, regardless of what's decided here, we will continue to work with the commission. I will say this, when we were monitoring our position daily last fall, we were factoring in the deferred payments into our equation and basically said when we made the statement, if you see the gates locked, that means we got to start cutting checks for all deferred payments and price laters. Now, it would have been our option to price that corn at that time. I mean, essentially that's where we're kind of stepping into the shoes of that contract and saying, you better take this now, this rate now, because we're essentially out of cash. So, you know, there's potentially you're taking that option away from the producer. The deferred payments is a matter of you didn't keep my money until January 1st. You gave it to me in November or December. And, of course, then the question is, well, would you rather have it now or not get it? I mean, so we were going we had that in the back of our minds, and we're going through that mental calculation. Well, I shouldn't say mental. It was on paper of what it would take to meet those obligations. I guess I just want to make sure that you understand, the commissioners understand that was part of our process. I guess as far as popularity, I'll let Roger speak to that.
Well, on the deferred payment contract, again, I think as producers are, you know, that's totally probably a tax situation. We have looked at some other options there last year. Some of them options were deposits in banks and savings accounts that we had producers interested in were kind of held in an escrow. And that was an interest to some. I don't think we had to enter into any of them, but we would have made that available. That's on the deferred payment side. On the deferred pricing side, it seems to be a very huge tool that the producers use. I mean, they like to haul their corn and sell it later. I mean, it's not so much that they're maybe speculating or anything else. They're just not ready to sell it that day, and yet they want to haul that day. That, you know, I guess we used to probably call it probably a little more open storage or open assembly, you know. And there was a time, of course, we either had to have them on storage or priced within a day, and some of them rules have all changed too. I do believe that, you know, we have a large percentage that starts that way before they get applied to a contract. It would hamper us somewhat. Is it something we can manage? If we have to, we'll have to manage that. But I do believe it would hamper us in our grain procurement.
You want to repeat that? It would help you? Or?
No, I think it would hamper us somewhat in our grain procurement. You know, I mean, again, if we have to deal with that, we'll deal with it. But
so I didn't get, and was there a popularity, a percentage, or a volume that is with
the present time?
Pricing?
At the present time, for example, nearby we have 140,000 bushels of what we call delayed price contract. Most of us always on the front end. You know, we have very little going out any place. I mean, there's really no reason for it going out there. So it's mainly a front-end contract where they're bringing the corn in and they haven't established a price on it yet. Some of them are written under different terms. You know, basis contract. Actually, we kind of like basis contract. It helps keeps us even. For the deal is we're selling ethanol every day. So as we enter into a basis contract, I'm not sure if you would refer that to a deferred price or not, but we haven't set no futures on it yet. So some of it's clarification of the contract also.
Just to clarify, in statute, anything that results in payment 30 days beyond the delivery would be a voluntary credit sale.
Okay.
Maybe, and again, this is kind of disrupting things, but do either of the two producers sitting out there, or even three, I guess, if I call Keith one of them, do you guys have any thoughts on that whole thing? Because I don't, you know.
Personally, I don't like either one, and we'll use them very rarely other than maybe for a day or two delay if you're hauling and overhauled your contract and you know, price the other within a day or two. That is about the only way I will use either one of those. The problem we have as producers is right now on the Board of Trade, there's a tremendous carry in the market, and we want to capture that carry. So if I want to capture that carry, when we're limited to the number of tools we have available through our local elevators or our ethanol plant, we are stuck with the board. And I think most of us are getting better at using the board, but it is a whole new ballgame. So when we're using the futures board to protect our price, sometimes you have to do both. You have to use the futures board and fix that basis to kind of guarantee your price. But when it comes to delayed pricing or those deferred type payments, I don't use them very often. I feel they're too much of a risk in my operation.
Mr. Heber, I'm sorry, can I ask a question? Where would you, is the risk with you, the producer, or is the risk with the ethanol plant on a voluntary credit sale? Obviously, one's betting it's going up and the other one's betting it's going down, so it's kind of like two bulls bucking their heads.
I consider it, I've entered into that arrangement, the risk is with me. I know the courts haven't always ruled that way, but I sure consider it, if I'm entering into that kind of arrangement, I consider the risk with me.
Thank you.
I fully agree the risk is with a producer, and we go into price later and deferred contracts with that. When we're blessed with a good year and I thought is the year we don't have to defer or prepay any expenses. That means we've had quite a few bad years in a row, and we've seen that, and we defer cautiously. We'll say that, last year we knew with the ethanol plant with having some financial problems. We looked at different elevators, we called different elevators, and we talked to them, what's your financial position, where are you at, and made our choice of knowing we would have to do a balance between deferred and prepaying expenses. We try to look at it knowing that we are the ones at risk. Where do we do it at? Price later, we look at as a short-term tool, not something. A lot of times, though, you get a price later, you can go out 9 months. We don't. We figure our storage and our interest costs and everything, and I don't know that we've ever gone that far out on a price later. It's usually a short-term based on what information we've been able to gather from talking to different elevator managers.
Would you like to pick your poison then? I mean, as a producer, do you see this as a hindrance if we were to put some restrictions on voluntary credit sales? Would it hinder you, or would you like that option too?
Yes, I'd like to pick my poison, as you said, yes.
Okay.
Mr. Melloff, I want to get your take on this. I always sort of favor disclosure over mandating action. Of course, I do echo your concerns. In this sort of environment, of ECS can be maybe quite a little bit more risky than a lot of people realize. Would it ease your concerns if we required that written disclosure be provided to each person indicating an interest in entering into a VCS contract? That letter, which would be drafted by the PUC, would indicate, one, that the license held is it's a temporary license, and that, second, that VCS contracts are not covered by the bond required by the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission, and so producers enter into that contract at their own risk. And then, I think the commission would want some piece of paper those folks would sign saying that they had received that, which would be held, by the ethanol plants. Does that mitigate most of your concerns?
Mr. Chairman, we currently have a lot of that already. It's built into the requirements. The voluntary credit sale contracts have to be on a form approved by the commission, and one of those requirements is in bold or red ink, initialed by the producer, that there is no statutory bond coverage when you enter into that contract. So
I know we've got that in the contracts, and I know that we've got, I think it used to be that those sort of rules had to be posted, or that notices had to be, signs had to be up saying that the PUC grain rules are on site and you can request to see them. But I think what we've heard as we've revised these rules is people don't really read those, and nobody ever requested for them, and having hard copies of the rules didn't ever really work. Is this a different way to make sure the producer understands the risk that they're entering into? Now, if you just think it's redundant and it doesn't educate anybody further, let me know.
Well, it certainly would. Redundancy is, I don't know if you ever took college algebra, but redundancy pays off. So I would say certainly that would be a further notice to the producers that they were entering into a situation like that. I would like to clarify just a couple comments that were made by, I can't remember who made them, but a price later contract is much different than an open storage situation, which is a bailment situation. And with escrowing money, and I appreciate everything Mr. Cyrus said about taking into consideration the open contracts or the voluntary credits contracts that are on the books as they make their purchasing decisions. But I'd also like to note that a lot of it could be that those decisions may be taken out of their hands. And in the case of the bank, within their rights, called in all the notes that were due, that the title of that corn is already passed. And if there's money sitting there, even if it is earmarked for a certain purpose. The bank would more than likely have first crack at any of the assets, including those.
One other thing I like about this specific disclosure is that, you know, producers who, you know, fully understand that VCS contracts are essentially at their risk might not have any problem with them if they're dealing with an elevator because they know the commission has reviewed their books and has some comfort level. Letting them know on that piece of paper that this is a temporary license. This is in, this is not a typical operating procedure. The commission maybe might cause a little more diligence or scrutiny by that producer who thinks, oh, well, maybe this is a VCS contract that I would be a little more worried about entering into than I normally would be. Any value to that?
Certainly, I think there's value to that.
Okay. Glacial Lakes Corn Processors, Mr. Sire, any thoughts on, you know, I don't know that I'm completely opposed to a prohibition. I'm just trying to think about a way that I think makes more sense. What do you think about additional disclosure?
We would be in favor of that. We would put it as large a print as you want us to put it. We would put it in every color that we would be asked to do, and on our website, at the time of making that contract, whatever you ask us to do. So we would not be opposed to that at all.
Thanks, Mr. Mohoff. Another question. We have heard that the Mina elevator has some significant exposure to Glacial Lakes. Have we heard anything from Mina elevator about how they view this proceeding today?
Well, can I answer that?
Yes.
I shouldn't jump in here, but the elevator that we primarily utilize in Mina is Keith Haney's elevator.
So. Well, I knew he was out of Ipswich, so I'd forgotten that there was.
We pull it out of there, and we've instituted some other measures that would keep the corn going and more frequent payments and such. So,
other questions.
I might just make one observation here, and it's one Ms. Weiss noted. I mean, the use of the word temporary license has been used, and that may or may not be what you guys do here. I'm just thinking, maybe thinking in terms of if you were to just grant the waiver as requested with whatever conditions you decide to use it, we might think more in terms of of referring to it as a license granted pursuant to a waiver, you know, or something like that, you know, or conditional license. Again, that's a nitpicky point, but unless temporariness is one of your conditions, it may not be. They're all temporary.
conditional license, I think, is, yeah, I think you're right. Point well taken. Other comments, questions? Mr. Rizloff.
Yes, I'd have a couple. Maybe more on a macro basis, but a real simplistic look at this industry would tell me that the rising price of gasoline right now isn't hurting you a whole lot. Is that correct? Is this a positive thing for your industry?
Well, if ethanol will follow it, yes, it's a positive thing because corn has been dropping as of late. Again, I want to go in without a visual, and I apologize that we didn't bring that visual, but, back in 2005, 2006, you had this wide margin between the two commodities, and then in 2007, that gradually came to this, and now they're just on top of each other, so what one does, the other tends to do. As of late, and when I say late, 2, 3, 4 weeks, we've seen them start to widen again. So we're not sure if ethanol is going to follow gasoline, which is, would pull them apart. And because corn's been going down and ethanol has been staying pretty much where it is.
Well, it just seemed to me that there would be, though, some upward pressure, even if there's a differential. As we've seen gasoline go from about $2 a gallon to about $2.80, I think, last time I checked the marquee, you would think there would be some pull upward ethanol, even if corn isn't necessarily increasing in price at that point. But I don't know.
We did not see that occur last year when the gas went over $3. I mean, yeah, ethanol went up, but corn followed it, so we really didn't gain any ground. And I would, your statement, we would think that, I would hope that, because that will mean that, there is some margin returning to the industry. So, that's what I hope for every day on my way into work and every day when I'm going home, is that are we finally at a point where maybe ethanol starts to act a little bit more like gasoline and less like corn? Because when they're acting together, there's just nothing in there for us to gain.
My question would be this, then. Does anyone have any idea why it would be trending toward one measure and not the other? It's a huge industry at this point, the ethanol industry. And as I look on a macro basis, what the commission is trying to do, I think gaining some assurance about where perhaps the market is moving might be helpful. But, you know, I understand forecasting is extremely difficult when we're dealing with agricultural commodities and apparently with petroleum commodities as well. But is there any sense, as you look down the road in the industry, where you expect, which index you expect it to follow, whether it be price of corn or the price of gasoline?
Well, I think that's, Mr. Rizloff, I think that's dependent on a couple of things. Number one, clearly the industry overbuilt itself, and it met the demand and the opportunity, I suppose, for the large returns that were occurring. But currently, the way the industry is built, it can meet the demand for the country. So what do? We either decrease the supply or increase the demand. The industry is looking to increase the demand. I like to tell our board, you don't have to convince too many people around Watertown and Hayti and Ipswich that they ought to burn higher blends of ethanol. But we do need to convince people in the Denvers and the Los Angeleses and the Las Vegases to burn more ethanol. We are definitely an exporter of this product. I remember one time there was a tour of the Mina facility, and they said, well, does all this ethanol go into Aberdeen? And my response was, if the state burned nothing but ethanol, we could supply a fourth of it right here in one plant. One 100 million gallon plant, assuming the state consumes around 400 million gallons of gasoline a year. Looking at the supply side, as plants shut down, may not be a bad thing for those of us that are still operating. We believe that this is a game of survivors and that the longest that stand in this are going to come out ahead in the end.
We're in the midst of, if I could rephrase that, we're in the midst of a market shakedown, reaching some sort of producer-supplier equilibrium, I would.
Exactly.
If I could. I had about 50 questions, but I think most of them have been answered. But I did want to note a couple things. This is a cooperative.
Yes.
And there's a catch-22 aspect to this in a whole number of different ways, but there's no question that any conditions the commission attaches will, at least I would expect, lead to higher operating costs. And because you have a number of producers that are also shareholders, the benefit, both exists. There's almost a zero-sum game involved here.
Let me respond to that. I think, for instance, if we were to have to or if we were to seek a higher bond, I guess the alternative to that is not to buy corn directly from the producers. With a 15 to 20 cent markup, it doesn't take long when you're going through 100,000 bushels a day to cover the cost of that bond. So I think what we've done internally is we've ranked the importance of these, and certainly buying corn directly is of our highest priority. And certainly fits in with our plan to go out and attempt to obtain more corn directly from the farm and from the producer.
I think the catch-22 aspects are interesting, whether we're talking about bonding or maybe paying twice as often, whatever's done. But I guess my last question is this: have you? And I think you answered it, but you have done a financial analysis of what would be cheaper, increased bonding versus paying, within 3.5 days, let's say, than every 7 days. And I'm not holding you to that, but you talked about having the payment time. But you've done an analysis. If you jump the bond from 500 $500,000 to $1 million for each site, that would be a lower cost alternative than paying more often on a time value of money basis?
You know, there's not a lot to gain in returns out there right now. As far as if we let that excess cash sit there, again, it'd be more of an administrative issue. We'll issue more checks, we'll incur more postage, whereas we might consolidate multiple deliveries over a week. Now we're going to split that up and maybe issue two checks and two letters. Our costs are primarily there. Again, I think we've looked at it from a large scale and said, you know, we're willing to shoulder whatever additional costs come along, knowing that our ability to buy corn directly is by, in a way, the better approach and will compensate. We've kind of encountered these difficult times late last summer, early last fall, there's just no normalcy to how we do business. I mean, we're putting deposits out there with North Central, for example, that there's a cash deposit there. We've encountered different challenges before that's not how we've done business in the past. There's certain vendors that have tightened up a little bit on us too. We've agreed to do that. For the most part, I guess we've just been able to adapt, and we keep chasing the higher, wherever there's a volume involved, that's what we go after.
Well, one last point I'd make and, you know, quit. But it seems to me, my concern is not that you take a week to pay. My concern would be in having Mr. Melhoff know if all of a sudden you took 2 or 3 weeks to pay. And I think that would, you know, from my point of view, not being a commissioner, but being a staff person, That's when I would get concerned. I don't know if having it makes all that much difference, but I know tripling it would appear to me to make a big difference.
Good point, Mr. Rizloff. And the producers would be the probably the first signal that something is going on. If they didn't get their check on the Thursday, let's say it's a Thursday, there would be calls into us. There would be calls into you. If it went to Friday, it'd get even worse. Keep in mind, we're producing pretty significant amounts of a product in two locations. That would be the first red flag. CEO of this organization, I can say that I would not permit something like that to occur. I would come out and basically tell folks that, as I indicated earlier, hey, folks, the gates are locked. We can't pay for what you're going to bring us. We can pay for what we have, but we can't pay for what you're going to bring us. That's been a position on our board. We've made that statement in the public. We've told producers that when they call in with those concerns. We to some extent, the elevators would feel it as well. The Keith Haney elevators and the Watertown Co-ops and the Hovind Equities would feel it as well, because some of those were on more accelerated payment terms with presently.
Mr. Melhoff, I think I'm on the cusp here of making a motion, one of which would be some additional reporting requirements. Wanted to pick your brain about what you thought would be helpful as far as frequency and content of information.
I guess as far as frequency, once a week, if I could get an email from either Mr. Nealon or Ms. Dennison showing what their payables were, how much corn they purchased, and how much unpaid corn our company-owned unpaid were on the books at any given time. Just to monitor it. With respect to the, I know you didn't ask this, but since I'm talking, the talk about the increased bonding requirements, to me that seems a little bit of a cumbersome condition to put on it. It's a little vague in exactly what they would be able to offer. And I would hate to put a condition on there that maybe they would not be able to meet, and then have to come back here again and rediscuss it. So So from my perspective, if we were going to go one or the other, I know it's been discussed, frequency of payment or increased bond, I would prefer to see frequency of payment, which would cut the exposure in half, theoretically, rather than the increased bond, because I know that they can do this. I'm not convinced that they would be able to secure a doubling of their current bond coverage.
Mr. Knopf, I want to make sure that whatever we do isn't too much of a burden. I mean, weekly reporting, I mean, might monthly reporting make sense and up until the point that their working capital drops below a certain point, in which case we'd want more frequent reporting? I mean, I don't know, pick a magic number, $1 million of working capital below that, maybe we'd want something more recent or more frequent. Thoughts?
Well, I guess so. When I mentioned weekly, I thought I got an affirmative nod. If you're comfortable with monthly, I'm certainly willing to defer to whatever you would want. But because I'm with you, I mean, I certainly don't think that the warehouse division should become a burden on anybody in the industry. So that's kind of got to thread that needle as to offering protection versus burden. So.
Well, I ask you and Mr. Steyer, I mean, I'm throwing numbers out here for conversation's sake. I mean, is monthly reporting up until working capital gets below $1 million and then having weekly reporting, is that workable? Or, I mean, those are three numbers that could all be adjusted pretty easily. Thoughts?
Commissioner Johnson, if we, I want to understand the two options here. We would go, Mr. Melhoff indicated, twice per week payments. I think that's correct.
Well, and let's divorce that from the conversation because I'm not there. I mean,
okay.
I'm just talking about reporting here.
Okay. We can provide weekly reports. We can provide monthly reports. It's not a significant issue to provide that weekly or even twice a week.
$1 million of working capital, that is almost completely arbitrary on my point. It's tied a little bit to what, I mean, if you said January was a really bad month, and that was around $1 million of negative cash flow, and I know that the numbers are not that tightly related necessarily, but is $1 million a decent number to be looking at as to when you think your operation is beginning to get in a more precarious financial situation? Or...
I would think that when we're at that point, yes, we're starting to feel the pinch just because of some of the fluctuations in cash flow that Mr. Smith identified earlier and I spoke to.
I'm going to offer this up for discussion's sake. I move that the commission waive ARSD 2010-12-15 and as a result issue a conditional license to Glacial Lakes Corn Processors. The conditions would be that a notice would have to be handed to everybody interested in entering into a VCS contract. That notice would have to be approved by the director of the grain division, and that the Glacial Lakes would have to have receipt of from the producer of having received that notice every time they're interested in entering into a VCS contract. In addition, that there would be additional reporting requirements that the director of the grain division or his designee would receive monthly reports. And that if working capital ever dropped below $1 million for Glacial Lakes, that those reports would begin to happen weekly. I would also want to make it very clear, although that this license is a 12-month license, that at any point Glacial Lakes could come in for a more traditional license and not be subject to the conditions, if approved by the commission for that. Let's pause and see if anybody has any suggestion. Mr. Smith?
Just one clarifying thing, and again, I notice there's an asterisk on the word working capital in your chart, right? And when we talk about working capital, of course, here we're talking about that figure, right? Without the gap adjustment, without the theoretical covenant non-compliance problem.
That's correct.
Okay.
The asterisk is we have approximately $3.2 to $3.3 million in a debt service reserve that is with our bank, held by our bank. It's a reserve that's required. We do not In this particular example, we do not include that in our current assets because we can't get at that cash.
Well, that and these current assets also don't include the current liabilities, right? Don't include the acceleration.
Correct. Okay. If we put the $161 million in there, this page looks completely different.
Okay, thank you. I apologize for interrupting, Mr.
No, that's fine, Mr. Smith. To add information to that notice, at least three things would have to be included. One, notice that Glacial Lakes Corn Processors, their plants are operating under a conditional license, and that VCS contracts are not covered by a bond, and so the producer is entering into those at his or her own risk. Again, open to discussion or comments or amendments.
Mr. Chairman, it would seem that with $400,000, well, with 100,000 bushels being purchased, and depending upon the price of corn, $500,000, we could run through, get down to a million pretty quick in some instances. I think there should be greater frequency of reporting as opposed to I'm far more comfortable with the frequency. And if there's not a burden on Glacial Lakes to report on a weekly basis, I think that that's beneficial to us. And so I'd be inclined to support a 1 week.
Let me give a couple of quick, because I really was where you're at.
I understand. Well, perhaps I don't, but I think I understand where you were how you arrived at that. But I'll let you go ahead. I'm just far more comfortable with a week.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways you're right, Commissioner. Here's the reason that I did a month until you get down a little bit. I really hate government ever collecting information that it's not going to carefully review and act on. Now, I believe that in this situation, Mr. Milhoff and his team would, of course, review this. But I'm also not entirely convinced that this is, if we take the long-term view, that this is going to be the last such situation we have like this. And so if we ever get into a situation in some future year where maybe we have six or eight of these conditional licenses, I'd want to make sure that we have a precedent set that means that we're collecting information in such a way that we know we're reviewing all eight filings, we're doing something with it. It seems as though having that sort of careful review every week is probably not a sustainable template for us to begin with. And so I thought, hey, $2 million looks pretty healthy, $1 million looks a whole lot less. So let's have sort of a two-tier system. That's where I'm coming from anyway.
What was the last comment you made there? A two-tier system.
Oh, a tier-two system. Basically, that you know, your standard reporting under a conditional license is once a month. But if your financials start to soften, then we're going to go into the more intensive reporting. But that intensive reporting is not required every single week if your financials are strong.
I'm not finished with that conversation, but I appreciate your I'm just going to let you go. Mr. Malhoff, you're comfortable with 1 week? Your division can handle those reports and review them on a weekly basis?
Yes, I'm comfortable with that, and particularly if Glacial Lakes is comfortable with providing it. Depends on how, I mean, you could make it more burdensome and have them report monthly with a whole lot of information that would be burdensome for us to review. I mean, it could be looked at a lot of different ways. And one of the problems with the two-tiered systems, with all respect, Commissioner Johnson, is that who's making the determination when you actually enter into that second tier and where is the information coming from? Currently, we require at least a reviewed statement that shows where you're at in the instance that, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you're describing. I mean, the responsibility would be on the grain dealer or grain buyer to say what system that they have to be in with the numbers that they present, rather than, because I certainly don't think it would certainly be burdensome to require a reviewed statement every month. from an accounting firm. So I think I like a basic report that's set up that shows, you know, the amount of payables that are on each week, what has been paid each week, and how much company-owned grain is on the books that's not paid for.
And
it's a fairly simple thing, and I think it would be a good barometer of what's happening with the corn that's coming in and the corn and the money that's going out to producers.
And as you were stating that earlier, and you repeated it again, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like there's one piece that's left out, though, and that is the duration that a contract has not been paid.
An excellent point.
Was that I didn't hear that in part of the what you were saying there. Is that part of it, or it just seems like it should be?
When you say duration, you mean when it's scheduled to be paid?
Grain's been delivered and it hasn't been paid for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever. It doesn't sound like that was part of what you were.
No. Well, I didn't mention that. But basically, and maybe Mr. Reedy could comment better, but we could just ask for their VCS contract report, which most of the grain handling software generates those pretty easily.
Okay.
Which you could just get a better look at.
And then for Glacial Lakes, in the discussion and what Mr. Melhoff has stated here, is that a challenging report for you guys to put together? Is that going to be cumbersome? I'm sure you can do it daily, but that means you're going to – and nobody's talking daily. You can do it hourly, I'm sure, but you'd have extra people to hire and a lot of extra work and hassle. And I agree with Commissioner Johnson, not interested in trying to make life difficult for you folks. And I truly support the waiver. We're just trying to figure out the machinations of it. Is a week going to be challenging for you folks?
Not at all. Mr. Melhoff brings up a good point about calculating what is the true working capital number. And not that we would ever do this, but if we wanted to stay below the radar, I suppose we could without an audit or a reviewed number, subject to essentially interpretation. So if we focus strictly on, you know, what's the obligation out there and did it weekly, we can deliver.
All right, thank you. And I appreciate Chairman Johnson putting out the grocery list for us to look at. And thank you. Thank you.
So, Mr. Mahoff, how often – I'm sorry. Go ahead, Commissioner Colbeck.
No, I was just going to say that I think Commissioner Johnson is looking at it as a governmental – standpoint. I guess I look at it more as a money standpoint. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but you're grinding about $40 million worth of product a month, correct? $400,000 a day. And then say you're getting 50, you said you have an unwritten rule of maybe 50 to 60% of that is coming directly from producers, not elements. So we've got about $20 million a month of exposure out there. Does that make sense?
Well, if I look at the 3 million bushels that each facility uses, and let's just focus on one facility, 3 million bushels at, let's just use $4 a bushel.
Sure.
That's $12 million. And then that times two facilities, $24 million. We're somewhat below half, so, we're back to $12 million.
Okay. So there's about $12 million out there in a month, correct?
Unless I'm missing something in my
okay.
mental calculation.
No, and that's
yes,
and that's sir. Kind of where I was at too. So a month or a weekly reporting to me does not seem burdensome when we're talking about $3 million.
Weekly reporting we can easily handle, and so, I appreciate the concern over regulatory burden here, but I think we would all admit that this is probably the least of our concerns. We could easily deliver this.
Okay, and then. That I guess is what bothers me is just the sheer volume of money that's circulating through your plant every week, your plants every week that I would like a closer eye on if we do approve this waiver. I do agree with the notice. And the other question I had is did your motion have anything of the settling the purchases more frequently? Because I agree, bonding coverage, they're not buying more product. So I think we maybe heard that about $198,000 of what would even be covered under the bond is about what you've got right now. So I don't think increasing the bond is going to – what's the use of $1 million worth of bonding if you still only got $198,000 worth of exposure? So did you mention the settling? No?
I did not.
Okay. I'm kind of partial to that. I know that if it's not a tremendous burden, I understand there's administrative costs to that. But if we could get that corn paid for and off the books, I think that would eliminate a little bit more risk to producers, too, rather than waiting a month. Like I said, the sheer numbers of this is what bothers me the most, giving a waiver for the vast amount of millions and millions of dollars that in 12 months could go through this plant. So.
It's a very, Commissioner Kolbeck, your observations are correct. It's a very cash-intensive business. I mean, on the other side, when we sell a unit train, if you've got 3 million gallons in there, which is roughly what it is, and you're at $1.50, that's a little lower than what we're seeing today. That's $4.5 million that you've just generated. That's not to count the distiller grains and the oil that we pull off in Watertown. So, I mean, it's a cash-intensive business, and we exchange a lot of cash.
And that's another thing, you know, the train derails, and pretty soon you're 2 weeks behind on a shipment out, and you got $4.5 million sitting there. So, but that's why I think the weekly is, and I think getting those corn purchases paid for and out the door is two of the things for a waiver. I think that I would like to see.
Just a couple comments on this reporting requirement. I mean, how often do we get financial information from most grain buyers?
They're required when they apply for a license to provide for a Class A license, which Glacial Lakes is seeking. They're required to provide a reviewed or audited statement every year. When the inspectors do their inspections, which happens at least once a year, oftentimes twice, they'll ask for internal financials and take a look at them. In case of Glacial Lakes, they post their unaudited statements quarterly on their website, so they're available.
So here's where I'm headed with this. Thanks.
So generally, just once a year, we ask for them. They're required under statute.
So here's my concern. We've got most grain buyers that are, in fact, not in any weaker financial situation than Glacial Lakes, and that information we're receiving twice a year. We've got an entity that is in only a technical violation, and we're going to go to 52 times a year. And I just think that's an intensity of reporting. I think we're jumping. I mean, if this was, I mean, $2 million of working capital, I'm going to suggest is in significantly stronger position than many of the grain buyers that we've got operating in South Dakota today. So I'm nervous about going to 52 times a year. Mr. Meloff, I think you make strong points about, you know, well, of course they could, you know, they decide when they're under $1 million of working capital, so there could be some concerns there. But listen, with almost everything we do around here, if somebody wants to falsify information, if somebody wants to report different information about what they're bringing in and putting out on these weekly reports, or for telecommunications providers or for energy providers, if somebody wants to falsify reports, it's going to take us a while to figure it out. And so we rely mostly on what happens to people once they get caught lying, as opposed to having to verify. I mean, we're not going to be weekly verifying the veracity of the reports they're sending us via email. So we're in the same situation. We're relying on Glacial Lakes to tell us the truth as they know it or believe it. I appreciate Glacial Lakes very much being willing to provide weekly reports, and indeed it looks like that is probably what's going to be required. I'm always a little nervous to take the industry's word for it when the industry is feeling pressure from government. I think we see lots of folks in the healthcare industry and in the energy industry and the electrical industry, particularly in other states, who don't fight government regulation because, frankly, their back's up against the wall. I mean, they'll sort of cut the best deal they can cut, and Glacial Lakes wants a license. They believe they need a license to function. And so in that context, a weekly report isn't that much work for them. I just wonder if that's the precedent we want to set. I'd also note that when we start getting weekly reports, let's make no bones about it, we're shifting a huge part of the liability and exposure from Glacial Lakes to the PUC. because now producers are believing we're reviewing these reports weekly, and if something goes bad and people start to lose money, it is, at that point, way more our fault than Glacial Lake's fault. And so if Jim Milhoff is on family vacation for Monday and Tuesday and is really busy with a bunch of legislative meetings on Wednesday, and then we look at it on Thursday, well, the next week report's coming the next day. I mean, I just think weekly is a lot of information. I'm glad Mr. Milhoff can handle it. I'm glad Glacial Lakes can handle it. But if one of my colleagues makes a motion to increase the two-tier system to a one-tier, always weekly system, you know, I'm going to have a hard time being supportive of that. So, and with that, you know, maybe we just might as well have one of you make the motion so we can clean that up and move on to the next piece.
But everyone else is going to be on a one-tier system. The only person that's going to be on a two-tier system is someone who's on a conditional license.
By one-tier, two-tier, I'm talking about the people under a conditional license.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, okay. 52 times a year is what it looks like we're headed toward. For a company that's got $2 million of working capital and it's in better situation than lots of other folks, we're going to make report once a year.
But it's the same company that had to come to us for a waiver. Those are the only people who would have to report 52 times a year.
In this particular situation, it's not... This is a technical violation. Nobody disputed that. This is a bookkeeping issue, not a we're running out of money issue.
Yes.
And so as long as we're clear that a technical violation of an overly conservative accountant means that you're going to increase by, you know, 300 or 500% your reporting requirement to the PUC, great. And I've argued way more adamantly against this than I even believe it. I mean, I don't even think it's that bad. I mean, we've heard that this is not the end of the world to have a weekly filing. It's more of a principled deal.
And I appreciate that. I'm sure everybody else does.
You have a motion.
That's what I'm to infer that there is a motion on the table.
I have a motion on the table. I was pausing to just from a deference perspective. If somebody wanted to amend the motion, I'm happy to take that at this time.
That's why I was asking. I move to amend the motion by providing a one-tiered system and reporting on a weekly basis.
Motion has been made. Any further discussion on the motion?
The more frequent purchases is not in the motion either, is it?
We can take that up once we're dealing with the amendment to the motion.
Gotcha.
Any discussion on the Hansen amendment? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes no. Motion carries 2-1. We're back to the motion as amended. Any further discussion or amendments?
I'd like to amend the motion to actually that the applicant will settle out more corn purchases more frequently. And on a timeline on how more frequently would be, do you have any suggestions on that, Jim? I was thinking every 2 weeks.
Commissioner Colbert, I think they're currently paying weekly. They pay this week for what was delivered last week. Is that my understanding?
That is correct. We pay weekly. I believe it's Monday.
And it's...
Monday or Tuesday.
Okay, and it's still on demand.
And if somebody comes in on demand, we will issue a check right then.
Actually, I'm going to withdraw that.
Any further?
I was under the understanding it was every 2 weeks, so I must have misunderstood the information.
Okay. Mr. Smith?
And this may be a real nit, but you stated you settle weekly. Would it be worth at least including that because of the situation here as a condition that they live up, that they keep doing that? Because right now that's just your policy, but there's nothing binding that says you have to do that, right?
Does it make more sense to have that be part of the weekly report? That, you know, Commissioner Hansen had raised that issue, I think, about, you know, what I'll call the payment lag. Does that make more sense? Mr. Smith, your thoughts?
Well, it I suppose it could be, except what happens if we look at that and then it's not like that, you know? I mean, we haven't put anything in there that says it's required to live up to that payment frequency. I suppose we could...
Well, for that matter, why are we collecting the reports? I mean, what happens if the information Jim gets isn't to his satisfaction? I mean, what what options are available to the commission. I mean, I guess if it got so bad, we'd go shut an operation, we could revoke a license, but under what rules, what criteria would we have to make that determination?
I think it would just be whatever conditions you put in here, really. I mean, I think that's what it gets down to.
Well, we don't have any of those conditions. I mean, we don't say when X is greater than Y, we revoke the license. And at some point, we've got some verbiage and rules and statutes that I think might guide us, but...
Right. I mean, I think we have that. And again, that's why, to me, at least, if you want to maintain, and we think the important thing in lieu of bond is keeping current on payments, to me it would make sense to specifically include a condition of that effect.
Well, I mean, let's pause for just a moment, because I'm more familiar with the grain elevator, you know, the grain warehouse provisions, where I do know there's a fair amount of specific wording about that the commission can come in and seize an operation. Grain buyers are different, and those statutes have changed quite a bit in the last 2 years. Mr. Melhoff, if you see something in a report you don't like, what options are available to you?
I guess like Mr. Smith said, I think with the options that would be available in this case, because the statutes currently don't require any weekly reporting, so the statute does require payment on demand, but it doesn't speak to how often you have to do it.
Okay, let's say you see the financials are turning ugly, you don't like it. Are there criteria that the commission can use for the revocation of a grain buyer's license? I mean, let's dig into the statute here and...
We can revoke a license for, evidence of it, or not necessarily, acts of insolvency, failure to pay, slow to pay, a bank coming in and seizing the accounts, things like that. There's nothing... You know, in statute that says if a financial is looking bad, you know, unless it actually crosses the line where they're not meeting the requirements.
So now I really need to get over this, but now we're asking for all these reports. The information we've requested in that report doesn't deal directly with any of those things you mentioned. So, you know, to use, you know, Mr. Rizlov's comment, you know, now we've got this sword. What are we going to do, sit on it? What options do we have available? I mean, if the license has been given, the only opportunities we have to revoke it, if it's, you know, no pay, bank steps in, financial insolvency, I mean, do we just want to see that the Titanic's going down before we get the distress call?
I think that we do that here with what Mr. Smith suggested, to require that they pay on a weekly basis. If we get their reports and they don't and they haven't paid on a weekly basis, well, now we have a cause of action.
Okay, but the... So let's say we require that they pay weekly, but the reports that we just are part of the motion now previously didn't ask whether or not they were paying weekly. They're talking about, Ms. Semler?
Oh, I was just going to indicate that I think a failure to pay is the issue that we need to be most concerned about. That I agree, I don't know what we'll do if we don't like the financials. However, the information maybe that we should be requesting is the payment lag, as you called it earlier. And I think we could do something about that.
So you had articulated some information earlier, maybe an hour ago, Mr. Melhoff, that you wanted that information, that you wanted that report to include. What was it again?
What's been paid? What's payable? What they have on the books that's company owned that's not paid yet, and then basically which that would be included in just their monthly their VCS contract report, which would include those two things.
So how do if there are no pays, how does that information help us?
Well, we can track that and we can see if their payables are getting larger significantly from week to week. Mr. Rizlov suggested that, you know, it's not necessarily a problem that they're paying every week and that we have to have it twice a week. What the problem is that they're playing every week, but now it's every 3 weeks or every 4 weeks, and that starts extending.
So but that's what I'm getting to. Isn't it the payment lag that matters more than all of that other stuff we're talking about? I mean, you're right. You can back into some of those numbers, but, I mean, should this report just be one number, maybe two? I mean, what's your payment lag, and has anybody had any – have you refused anybody payment?
I think that all of that information is required to kind of monitor that.
I just don't want to get us in a situation where we see that the financials are growing a little more tenuous, but we don't have anything we can do about it.
Well, we're not really talking about financials here. We're just talking about payables. So we're actually not looking at their working capital or their equity. We're just looking at the grain that's coming in and the money that's going out and looking for consistency each week. So in a sense, that report is showing that they're paying on a weekly basis. What Mr. Smith suggested was if part of the order should be that they have to pay on a weekly basis, or if we just allow it to remain their policy,
so
if they could change it at their discretion.
So if we see that they're paying every week like clockwork and taking care of all of their outstanding payables from the week before, is there still information in requesting specific bushels in and payments made? I mean, is there additional value to that? I just want to make sure that we're asking for is information we're going to use.
I think that would be valuable information, yes.
Okay. Great. So Mr. Smith made a suggestion that we require that they pay weekly. Mr. Sire, I mean, from an operational standpoint, is that acceptable, and does there need to be any flexibility in that if the commissioner were to make such a motion?
No, sir. We're doing that right now.
Okay. Anyone wish to make such a motion?
It's got to be an amendment, correct? Okay. Amendment to your motion. Mm-hmm. Make an amendment to the motion that the motion states that the company will continue their weekly pay payment schedule.
Okay, motion has been made. Any discussion on the motion? I think it makes sense. Any further discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed. Hanson?
No.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 2-1. Any further comments or action on the pending motion? Okay, so to reiterate, and everyone feel free to stop me if I'm misstating something, but the commission would waive 2010-12-15, grant a conditional license to Glacial Lakes Corn Processors, a notice containing information on that conditional license and VCS contracts and their non-coverage by bonds would be included in a notice approved by the director of the grain division. Receipt of such a notice would have to be accounted for, and there would be additional weekly reporting made to the PUC grain division, and that payment would have to be made at least weekly, as is the current practice for the ethanol plants. All right, what have we missed or misstated?
What's in the report?
Go ahead.
I would suggest that you just add until such times as their financial statement comes into compliance with the statute.
So in other words, if their covenants were to change in 3 weeks, they're in compliance, the waiver's over with, they can get a grain dealer's license?
Correct.
That would require additional action by the commission, in your thoughts? We'd need to make a vote to grant them a non-conditional license, or would you just, this would automatically transfer?
I'd defer that to Mr. Smith or Ms. Simler. I think if you just put the language in there that these requirements are in place until they come into regular compliance.
Well, but I'd want to make it explicit whether that once they meet the requirements you're talking about, then they're no longer conditional, or is a separate action, a non-conditional license, need to be issued by the commission?
This is probably just preference. I think you could do it either way. Why don't we have it to where it comes back here and we have a formal finding? you know, that would let us have an opportunity in case there's somebody out there who disagrees to have an opportunity to be heard.
I like it. And so we'll, and that was part of the original motion, I just forgot to misstate it, that we would make it clear that at any time Glacial Lakes could and request a non-conditional license from the commission during this next 12-month period. Anything else we've missed or misstated? Good catch.
Maybe what's in the report, do we want to, that's probably not part of the motion, or?
No, it probably makes sense to be explicit about that. At the end, I'd want, you know, and other information requested by the director of the division. But, Mr. Milhoff, why don't you just outline once more for us the things that you would want in such a report, and we'll incorporate that in the motion.
The current grain payables, what was paid the previous week or most recently, and the unpaid company-owned grain. So basically their report, their VCS contract report.
Okay. Anybody have any additions to that? All right, hearing none, I think we've got a fleshed out motion. Is there any further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. And great, so that's done. I think that's the last thing to come before us in this morning's portion of the agenda. And so unless there is an argument, I don't, from an open meetings perspective, Ms. Wiest, can we come back in at 2 if we said 1:30?
Yes, I think so.
I'd like lunch. So for those listening on the Internet and throughout life, we will, we're going to recess, and we'll come back at 2 o'clock to take up the Otter Tail Power rate case. Thanks.